I think it's important for all of you to share very intimately with me what I do in the way of conscious disciplining myself as we meet. I am an experientialist. My grand strategies, which I'm discussing with you, of coping with problem solving, is one which has an important name, operational. The word name operational came to be prior to science, I think, it was the invention of Percival Bridgman at Harvard, a natural philosopher at Harvard, who invented a term early in the century when Einstein made his first announcements. And Percival Bridgman at Harvard, a natural philosopher, said he was deeply interested in how it happened. Science, in general, was caught so off guard, so unexpecting of Einstein's kind of announcement and the viewpoint that was demonstrated by Einstein. And he became a great student of how all the circumstances surrounding Einstein's developing the thoughts that he had developed. And he then found that Einstein was concerned with not just some data discovered in an experiment, but all the circumstances surrounding that faithful reporting of the immediate, local, intimate conditions under which the discovery was made. And I will come back to that, but give a working demonstration of why Einstein felt it was so important to record all the circumstances as well as that which was specially isolated out and discovered. The example that I'm going to give you is my own invention, but I did include Einstein and Einstein's philosophy and my own interpretation of how he came to develop his equation and other of his strategies in my first book, Nine Chains to the Moon. And because I had three chapters on Einstein, my publishers, who were Lippincott of Philadelphia at that time, this is mid-30s, about 1935, said that they found that I had three chapters on Einstein, and at that time there was a general myth. There were only nine people in the world who could understand Einstein. They said they looked at all the lists of people who understood Einstein. I was not on any of the lists. In fact, they didn't find me on any list and of any authority, and they felt that for me to be writing three chapters on Einstein would make them Lippincott be accused of being a partner to charlatanry, that I was just a faker. And so I was a little stung and still quite young, and I simply wrote back, in a sense quite facetiously, to Lippincott saying that Dr. Einstein had just come to America and was in Princeton at the newly organized Institute for Advanced Study, and I suggested they send my typescript to him, that he would be the best authority. I really did not think they would take me seriously about that, and I forgot all about it. And it was about 6 months later that I had a telephone call from a doctor in New York. And he said, my friend Dr. Albert Einstein is coming in to spend the weekend with me. And he has your typescript, and he would like to talk to you about it. And could I possibly come on Sunday evening to his apartment in New York? So you imagine I didn't have any engagements that would interfere. And I had very few engagements in those days. Nobody wanted to talk to me. And I did come then to the apartment, and it was a wealthy man, and he had a large living room, and in more or less Germanic kind of style, people were sitting around the walls of the room, and he was sitting pretty much in the middle, and I think later on he might have played music for them. When I came in, I brought them to this long room up to meet him. I don't know how much was psychological within me, but I really had the most extraordinary feeling of being in a presence of almost an aura of him. He immediately excused himself from the company and took me out to a little library that was just off the main hall of the apartment. And on the library table was my typescript and under the light. And we sat down on the other side of this desk, and he said, he'd been over my typescript, and he was writing to my publishers to say that he approved of my interpretation of his thoughts in the way in which I had explained his his translation of philosophy. A philosophy of his which had been published in the New York Times Sunday magazine in New Year 1930, called The Cosmic Religious Sense. It was a very, very inspiring piece, and I had asked the publishers if I could quote it in my book, and I did. Having then this chapter on his philosophy, I then had another chapter on the way I felt that he interpreted how he applied that philosophy to all of his own grand personal strategy of his life, and how he came about developing his thoughts on the equation. Then I had a third chapter, which I said that historically great scientists, individual scientists, make discoveries. The academy doesn't accept right away. Later on, they do accept. Then it gets to be in the schools, and this gets to be in the general atmosphere of everybody's thinking. At this point, engineers and inventors, within that atmosphere of thinking, make some invention. And then gradually some industry takes on that invention. That takes quite a while. There's a lag. Finally, various things are being produced, which bring about a new environment under which social changes have to occur. And politics then has to take care of the take-up on the new orientation of man, all brought about indirectly from the original scientist's thinking. And I said, then my third chapter was, I developed a hypothetical picture of how humanity would be living. It was called E equals MC, second power, equals Mrs. Murphy's horsepower. And then I was looking at the everyday life of Mrs. Murphy under the circumstances of everybody really being completely convinced of the validity of Einstein's thinking. His equation had not as yet been validated, as it was later by Fission, at the time that I was writing. Anyway, he said he did approve of my two chapters, my chapter explaining how his philosophy was interpreted in his action, his thinking. But he said this third chapter about Mr. Murphy's horsepower, and his words were, I'll imitate him because I remember this so very well. And he was very gentle, and he said, this third chapter, young man, you amaze me. I cannot conceive of anything I've ever done having the slightest practical application. And he went on to explain that he had evolved his thoughts as possibly being useful to the astronomers, to the astrophysicists, to the cosmogoners, the cosmologists, but that it have any practical application or nothing. And that he did approve, and they did go on with the publishing of the book. That's very interesting, because this meeting occurred about a year and a half before Hahn and Stresemann, and then Lisa Meitner, discovered theoretical fission. And then there was a whole set of events which followed, which most people are very familiar with. And then the German Jewish scientists, getting the word as quickly as they could to out of Germany, because they thought it would be used immediately for armaments in Germany. And the word did come to America, and there were theoretical studies, and then came the conclusion of the scientists that fission was actually possible. So there was the quandary of the scientists, and how, because politicians don't listen to scientists, on how to get word to Franklin Roosevelt. So they all decided that Einstein was by far the most highly accredited of scientists, so they asked him to go to see Franklin Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt did appropriate, but at that time it was an incredible amount of money, $85 billion for the Great Manhattan Project. And then ensued then the Enrico Fermi pile, with all of which history most of you know. But it was interesting to me that I heard from this man 2 years before the theoretical fission is envisaged, that he did not have any slightest idea of anything he'd ever done to have any practical application. Because the first practical application the Enrico Fermi fire completely validated his theory of the amount of energy that was being stored in the given mass. So the very essence of what was going on. So the first practical application was Hiroshima. And having heard that from that man just before this occurred, I realized the unhappiness and consternation that he experienced when the first practical application was Hiroshima. In fact, his last days were spent greatly devoted to trying to get the scientists to realize their responsibilities and how they were being exploited, and brought about his consternation brought about the development of the Association of Atomic Scientists and the publishing of the Atomic Scientists Bulletin and so forth. And he expressed himself very vigorously his great unhappiness about this. But to have heard from that man before he realized that it would be a practical application, it would come in the political field, was a very extraordinary experience. But I do have then the personal confidence that when I interpret Einstein and talk about him, which I do very frequently, I do did have his personal approbation of my capability to do so. So I'm giving you then a hypothetical example of what Einstein employed as a strategy of thinking, which brought about Bridgman's development of the word operational. I'm going to give you then a man in a railroad train going west across the desert. And his train is going very fast. And he leans out of the window and drops a flaming apple. And he has, and he has a friend with him and so forth, they have a sextant to measure angles, and they have stopwatches and so forth, and he observes what he sees in a total azimuth of observation of the angle at which this light forms. Obviously, the flaming apple goes the opposite direction from him, and he sees it doing that, and he records his stopwatch exactly what angle of motion there was, some totally, as he looks back at it here, going back like that and look back towards the track. And he has a stopwatch reporting exactly how long it was in each of those positions of the various azimuth observations. Then we have another man who, at the same time, was standing way to the north of the train, was going west in the desert, and he had his observation instruments, his angle measuring devices and his stopwatches, and he sees the flaming apple go west instead of east. And he sees it in gradually go then down a little towards the track, towards the land. And he makes all of his measurements exactly what it did, and he describes that in the total his total frame of reference. Then we have another man who was standing on the track way to the west as the train approached, and all he saw was this flame go hesitate like this and go in towards the earth. It was just a straight line going like that towards the center of the earth. And he measured everything with his angle, azimuth, and his stopwatches. There's another man standing under it. As this happened, the train was going over a trestle, and there's another man standing below the trestle, looking up at me and seeing this whole thing, and he makes his observation what he sees. You find out the total angles of the observation, all the timing, everything came out. Each one was really very, very accurate, and they all come out completely differently. And for this reason, Einstein then felt that all the circumstances must be reported, and not just what it is you happen to find on your scales there as you weighed the phenomena, what went on within the test tube. This brought about Bridgman's feeling there should be a name for the inclusion of the unique circumstances which the observations are made. And he again gave the name operational, which he used to differentiate from a school of philosophy that was then in operation, coming from a man named Peirce at Harvard, called the school of pragmatism. In other words, it was pragmatic, but he wanted to use another word than pragmatic, so he was operational. Since that time, the word operation has come into very popular use in military ways and everything else, coming from scientists, but that's where the word began. I am in my geometry explorations, you see me getting into structures and so forth, discovering that the process of thinking produced a geometry. It was just the process of thinking about our experiences. And then our experiences were omnidirectional, so when you divide the experiences, all the ones outside, ones inside, it created a geometry. It just automatically produced a polyhedron or some kind of definition of what produced the insideness, the outsideness. So a geometry has been developed by being very careful to remember at the outset, every way I can, what I personally was conscious of in during when I participated in what I call, what we call thinking. And there are many other things I'm sure that went on that I am not conscious of, but the point was these are the things I was conscious of, and they led to a great many clues. So that's all operational procedure. So all of my geometrical exploration from there on is what I call really, it's all operational mathematics. I have absolutely no axioms. There's nothing that's said to be obvious. Where our eyes are too superficial, we now know how small the spectrum of the electromagnetic range of frequencies you and I can tune in. So we just cannot see adequately, say, that's self-evident. I find mathematics will play games assuming certain conditions to obtain, but I will not play. I am operational and often like to use the word experiential. I find that experiences can be inadvertent, they happen to us, and then there are the experiences deliberate. So I call one, it is experiential when it's happening to us, and then I make it experimental we manipulate the conditions arbitrarily. In my carrying on with you, doing what I'm doing on this particular occasion, I'm almost 80, within a few months of 80 now, and I am operating completely extemporaneously. I do not have any notes, and I have made up my mind to, because we have tried that on several occasions before at various schools around the country, quite a number of years ago, where I was asked to exhaust my thinking, my spontaneous thinking, before a class of students, and where I would not repeat myself except to do important reviews to bring back in a strand of thought which I'd introduced later that needed, you know, I'd be conscious of tying it in. And I was asked to exhaust my thinking, all the thinking which both the class and myself agreed was not in the general way of thinking, where I had any sort of unique viewpoint as a consequence of my operational procedure in developing my thoughts and self-discipline. In the previous experiments we've made, we had one that came to 52 hours, and because I am older, though I may be able to condense things a little more, we are all having such an acceleration of experiences. As I opened with you last night, the input of information is so great that I probably will take a little longer now than I did before, so we made an allowance of about 60 hours. But I also arranged out my affairs in such a way that I'll have the least possible intrusion into this pattern while I'm doing this, so that I will be able to really remember from day to day everything I've said over the total 60 hours. So I'm going to be really working on a mental tapestry, and I'm introducing thoughts and so forth, and I'm bringing in strands, and you'll find me continually weaving, but working on the grand strategy I introduced to you yesterday, working from the whole to the particular, the synergetic strategy, and requiring statements then out of the whole, and then some of the known inputs, and finding out other things as we go. This is the grand strategy. So that's enough about the sort of operational statement about what you find me sitting up here doing. And because this is a very unprecedented affair, it's an unprecedented affair just to have this beautiful videotape. I don't know, you've been looking at the quality of the picture. It is really superb. And a videotape is able to do what you do with just a tape recording of voice. You can run it over again. We can come back later on where I've been talking about some object that's not, we don't have models of, or pictures handy. We can superimpose it back in the film in the right place. It is very beautiful and a lovely medium. And so we're getting a really very faithful recording of a completely live experience of you and I. I had to have faces before me, human beings before me, so that I could really deal with their eyes, and I could not have people who came in and out. If somebody new appeared in the audience, and then spontaneously I want to bring him up to date with what the rest of us were thinking, so that we've had to have fairly clear-cut plans of how we would carry on here. I think all this is important to have in the picture, because that's operational information. In other words, personally, I do not look upon our undertaking such as somebody trying to create a beautiful moving picture, but they're just interested in the photogenic sort of maybe, and certain dramatic moments, getting the audience to feel certain ways. Therefore, I do not go by protocol or any things that try to erase anything that seems to be any kind of a small marring item. I think all of those things are going to be very important in operationally in whatever goes on here. We are all dealing in that extraordinary phenomenon called reality. Now, today I'm going to do some more revealing of things in fairly large ways. There was something that is very much in evidence in the room here, and I have not talked about, and that it relates to our word structure of yesterday, and that is, you see models around here with the, which these compression members do not touch each other. If you're trying to define, these are flexible cables between them. They're not stiff little wires. They're not rods. They are literally completely flexible threads. And they are high tensile threads, dacron, so they will not stretch. But you see them, a complex of compression struts that do not touch each other. And the only thing that's continuous is the tension. I became very fascinated in my early days getting into structures and actually building things, and particularly dealing with boats and the very great strength of the rigging and strength of your ship compared to kind of strengths that are usually exhibited in houses. And the differentiating of the rigging of a ship into the compressional spars and the tensional cables and stays, halyards, all the things you operate the ship with. So I'd like to think a little about any structural system. We introduced those words yesterday, so now you know what I'm talking about there. We find that there is in the structural system, there was a complex of energy events which interacted with one another to produce a stable pattern. But some of them were trying to explode, some are trying to escape the system, and others are containing the system. And I find then there's this phenomenon of compression and tension that is always and only coexistent. I think lots of people say, I have just a compression member. Well, that compression member is at high tide of a compressional aspect, but does have radial tension in it. And we say, I have a pure tension member. It's not so. You find that tension is also coexisting with compression. To make that clear to you, I'm going to then point out to you, first, I take a piece of rope. It's very flexible. And the only way that can give you any dimensional positioning stability would be when you have it tensed. So we take this piece of rope and our two hands and start tensing it. And the tighter I pull it, the more vigorously I pull it, the tauter the rope becomes. When we say taut, it means that its girth begins to contract. And so, as a consequence of my tensing it in this direction, pulling this way, it is contracting this way. That is, its girth is getting less. It's getting harder, you find it, tighter and tighter. That is, the more I pull it, the more it goes into compression at 90, in a plane at 90 degrees by pulling. That sounds familiar to you from yesterday. That's precession. In fact, the pulling is, the result of it is at 90 degrees. I find that when I take a number of rods, steel rods, and I find that they're very flexible. If I push it this way, they want to bend. I'm going to take a bundle of steel rods of 8 eighths of an inch in diameter. They're 4 feet long, so that they're so long they're very slender and readily bend if I push on their hands towards each other. They're all the same diameter, and I'm going to bundle them together in parallel, one to the other, a whole lot of them. In fact, two of them will come into contact, make cross-section through them. They come into contact like that. And now they can't get any closer to one another. They're actually tangent. A third one will nest in top of the two, makes it a triangle. I find that I can get six around one, making the hexagon form. We went in that pattern yesterday. I can get another row around and another row. And they get in this hexagonal pattern of closest packing. And I take a large number of these bundles, of these rods, and I've counted them out so they're going to come out in even hexagons, not just partial rings at the outer set. And taking it and bring them together enough, and finally, we keep doing this to them, they're finally getting that closest packing, very much tighter than they were at first. Now I put a tensile strap around them to hold them in the closest packing. So hold it, wrap them all the way around the whole length of this. Get absolutely tightly bound together. Now, I made so many of them that we have a total bundle about 6 inches in diameter, and it's 4 feet long. So its length to diameter ratio is 12 to 1. We find there's something in columns, compression columns, we call slenderness ratio. The Greek stone column, they found they could go 18 diameters high before the column wanted to collapse one way or the other. That's the slenderness ratio of the diameter to length. And we have the steel columns can get up today, some of the very good steels can get up as much as 36 to 1. Before we, I would see what happens when you load a column in compression. It wants to banana like that. It tends to go to arc of decreasing radius. Now, 12 to 1, I made that bundle of six inches diameter and 4 feet long, so well, it's an 8 to 1. It's a very short column, it's been called. It has really no tendency to banana at all. It's pretty much like there's a stone section, one section in the Greek column. Now, I'm going to put this column under a hydraulic press. In the hydraulic press between top member coming down, fantastic power being exerted here. And as the pressure comes on each one of those each of the rods that's in there, you know they want to bend. But because they are in closest packing, they can't bend towards each other. They can only bend away from one another. That's the only possible freedom. So that's exactly what they start to do. So keep loading it, and they want to go out like a cigar quite evenly. We have something called the neutral axis of a compression member. If you load it very closely on the neutral axis, then the load doesn't try to make it banana one way or the other. the slenderness could make it go almost any direction. A little tiny force goes that way. Now, we find then, very evenly loaded in the center, and being a short column, it tends to just become like a cigar. All the rods on the outside can bend away from one another. That's the only direction they can yield. Therefore, as they do so, they put an, we had a, they were bound together, so it puts an enormous strain on the binding, because they work against that binding. So that while we're deliberately loading in compression this way, the resultant is, it goes into tension in the plane at 90 degrees. It's exactly the opposite of what they did with the tension member going into compression. Here again, our friend precession. In engineering, that is called the Poisson effect. Now, often somebody's name being used really obscures a function, and it'd be better to say precession than Poisson effect. Then you really have the generalized principles covering all of these. Now, having recognized these proclivities of compression members, I saw them, a tension member, when I do tense it, tends then to go to arc of greater radius. Here we have something really quite different from the compression member trying to go to arc of lesser radius. That the tension member tries to straighten out and tries then also really to get all this effectiveness within the neutral axis. He tries to get in his own neutral axis to be, in a sense, most effective. Tension members really tend to gain strength as first used, build up quite a lot of strength. Now, I found that whereas there is a slenderness ratio in compression columns, there is no limit length to cross section. There's no slenderness ratio in tension members. If you had a better alloy, they could be thinner and thinner. Yesterday, I went into mass into attraction with you. This beautiful discovery of team play, really, of going from Kepler and Galileo to Newton. And we have then, there is then mass into attraction. And when we get to alloys of metals today, we know that the atoms are literally not touching one another. They are simply in closer proximity one to the other. I gave you the word synergy yesterday, and behavior of whole systems unpredicted by behavior of any of the parts considered separately. Chrome, nickel, steel is a very beautiful demonstration of synergy in physics and chemistry, alloy. We have a rule of thumb of a man of yesterday saying a chain is no stronger than its weakest link, and that seemed to be very obvious. By the same way, then, if I mix together a number of different chemical elements, our candy making would suggest that as when you could melt the sugar, then the whole thing comes apart, the nuts come apart, the nuts didn't fail, but the sugar comes apart. Whatever is the weakest element would be that in the chain would be all you have to look at. There's sugar in that peanut brittle, and so the sugar is the weak element. No, and peanut butter will be no stronger than sugar. When it comes to metallic alloys, things do not happen in that particular kind of way. I'm going to then take the chrome, nickel, steel, and we take the in the testing materials for their strength. The tensile strength per given cross-section area, some kind of cross-section area in America, square inch. The tensile strength of a square inch of material, so PSI, pounds per square inch, what is the cohesion of that material before it gets into two pieces? And that is the most prominent of all the strength testing that are carried on to learn about the structural strengths of materials. So I'm going to take when you're out testing, there is a point where the material will yield, and that's considerable time before, it'll still carry quite a lot before it fails. So the engineering usually then deals in that. If you don't want to get to a yielding point, then things are going to be in trouble. So I'm going to take then the one is called ultimate, the other is yield. Stones, masonry, for instance, have only about 50 pounds to the square inch tensile strength, the masonry itself. The stone is 50,000 pounds to the square inch compressional strength. So So stone has had an enormous ability to carry loads, but no strength at all in cohering comes apart. We have metals taken out of the stone that brought them tensile strength from the 50 pounds per square inch of masonry up to something like mild steel, primarily the iron, some carbon. This has a tensile strength in the commercially available materials, relative purity, that we get an ultimate in the mild steel of about 60,000 pounds per square inch as ultimate, yielding maybe around 50,000. We have the carbon, manganese, and so forth in there. In chrome, nickel, steel, the three prominent constituents are the iron and the chromium and the nickel. The chromium has a tensile strength of about 70,000 pounds per square inch. The nickel, about 80,000 pounds per square inch. So the weakest is the iron of the 50 to 60,000. And you say then, well, let's put these things together, and the weakest adulterates the whole, like the sugar, and it can never have any more strength than the weakest component. That has been the everyday thinking. And for this reason, alloys have really surprised man tremendously, because that society does not think synergetically. It assumes that all you have to know is about the parts, they add up. Now, chrome, nickel, steel. If I then get to I find that it does not come apart tensile in the tensile testing at the weakest or where the iron yields. I find then that let's try the chromium side. Well, it doesn't come apart. Try the nickel, 80,000. We're going to say a chain is now as strong as the strongest link. And we find that 80,000, it doesn't yield at all. In fact, we don't get it to yield until we get to 350,000. Supposing I say, I want to try and understand this extraordinary phenomenon by saying, I'm going to say a chain is as strong as the addition of the strength of all of its links, which everybody would say that's absurd. So I'm going to take 60,000 plus 70,000, that gives me 130,000, plus 80,000 gives me 210,000, but it doesn't yield till 350,000. Now, how does that happen? Well, this way it occurs. I want you to think then about geometries that I gave you yesterday of structural systems like the tetrahedron. I can take two tetrahedra of four stars each, and I can interrelate them symmetrically so that they're now eight stars in critical proximity, and they take position at the eight corners of the cube. A cube having two tetrahedra in it, because each square face had two diagonals, and you could take the cube and have the red set of diagonals, you find those are the six edges of the red tetrahedron, and you have the other diagonal of each face, the blue set, and that's the blue tetrahedron. You find the two come together with 8 points. Now, remember our mass attraction. These atoms are now in, there were only four, and their distance apart was the edge of the tetrahedron, which is on the cube is the diagonal of the face of the cube. Now, each of these eight stars, the nearest one is the leg or the edge of the cube away, not the diagonal away. Therefore, the critical proximity has been very greatly increased. So each atom now has three other atoms in much closer to them than the original three. So we have four cases of each having three, and remember that the interaction increases the second power of the relative proximity. So the coherence has gone up enormously. Then we find that we have that cube now with the eight corners. We find that there are six faces. So I can take an octahedron, which has six vertexes, and they will exactly match the mid faces of the cube. So each one of these elements coming in are just one of the such beautiful symmetrical structural systems of atoms. So I then finally have all the interpositioning of them, all in the same distance from the same common center, and we find the mass interattractiveness has just gone up in this exponentially. That's how we got the 350. other words, here we have an alloy, it's like the Milky Way. I take two stars in the Milky Way, and I could have another star intrude halfway between the two, and the intertraction is going to be fourfolded, so they don't touch each other. Now, I want you to then understand how that alloying is highly synergetic, and really appreciate that word. So I find then here's chrome nickel steel with its very high synergetic effectiveness of tensile strength. And these things really began to fascinate me very much. So I saw that tension members, they were not limited by cross-section in relation to length. If I could get a better material, I could make them longer and longer and thinner and thinner. That's exactly what went on in the history of suspension bridges. The first suspension bridges were actually made with great iron links, very great cross-section, very short span. We came to the Brooklyn Bridge, the first one where we were using cable, and used piano steel wire, which was one of those alloys. At a time when the mild steel was only about 50,000, and he got 70,000 with his piano wires. So he had relatively delicate cables carrying all that extraordinary traffic, this enormous span. Then when it came to George Washington Bridge, we've gotten very much finer because the alloys had so improved. And each one of these bridges getting up Golden Gate and then finally Verrazano. We're down to very delicate cables. So you not only have greater loads and greater lengths, but actually less section of materials per given load. We're approaching, because there's no limit ratio of length to cross-section and tension, that we're approaching infinite length and no cross-section at all. And I said, is that talking nonsense? I said, well, because tension goes in, tends to clear arcs of very large radius, I better then think about some very big systems. So let's think celestial here. Let's think, for instance, just the Earth and the Moon. And I see we can fly a little airplane right through the line between the center of gravity of the Moon and the center of gravity of Earth, and nothing happens. You don't sever anything. In fact, this turned out then to be the scheme of the universe where nature was using discontinuous compression and only continuous tension, which was invisible to you and I, because this extraordinary mass and attraction, which is invisible, which made it so perplexing what those planets were doing to the early observers. Apparently, then, the great structural scheme of the universe, I found these enormous masses intertracting one another, the Earth and the Moon, with these enormous distances between them. Then thinking a little more about what you and I have just reviewed about compression and tension, I would notice then that when I locate a column, I must try to stay on neutral axis, so it will not tend to bend one way or the other. And I see that loading a compression column, it tends to be more and more of a cigar, and finally if I keep loading it, and the press is finally going to get to be a sphere. Something extraordinary happens because any axis is neutral axis. Up to this time, there had been only one neutral axis, but suddenly any axis is neutral axis. So we found that ball bearings, spherical field balls, became the best compression members man had ever invented. So they carry these enormous loads and continually distribute their loads, so any aspect is neutral axis, so any aspect will do. And they're continually serving as they roll them around. So I found that nature was compressionally optimal and the spherical. So then I said, here's a scheme, here's that Earth is a sphere, and the Moon is a sphere, and the Sun is a sphere, and you got the atoms, all of them. But nature has the islands of spherical compression in a sea of comprehensive tension. So we have then what we call discontinuous compression and continuous tension. There's the scheme of nature. And man was not building his building that way. Man was building entirely compression on compression, brick on brick. Didn't see anything of any other kind of logic. This made me wonder whether it would be possible to make discontinuous compression, continuous tension structures. That's really what opened up this whole field. There are very many people now dealing with these structures. I call them tensional integrities. The integrity is in the tension because it is continuous, comes back to itself. It's always closed system. If it's open, then it'll make trouble. There must be closed system. And then I shorten the words tensional integrity down to tensegrity. So we call these tensegrity structures. absolutely even distribution, so they sound the same sound when anyone you're trying. If you tighten one of them, they'll all tighten absolutely evenly. And that's like any pneumatic ball. when you fill the whole ball, all the loads distribute absolutely evenly. So all went through enclosure. Now, these are balls, but you can see the holes in them. All balls do have holes, and they're too small for the gases. Molecules get out, they're full of holes. Now, this is simply a pneumatic structure. We'll go into that just a little bit more. But mainly I want to get to nature's scheme of discontinuous compression, continuous tension. Nature uses tensegrity. And I find then nothing could really make clear to me the degree of inefficiency that is imposed by man's non-synergetic thinking and his feelings you have to have brick on brick, the stone on stone. This taught me that I could possibly do much more in closing and be much more effective structurally employing the omni-triangulation, paying attention to all the things I've gone into with you about quantum of energy and the structures, the six vectors doing that, which of each one being push and pull, that the 12 are always there. They're both positive and negative, each one of the six. So there's a fundamental 12-ness there. Now, I'm going to go into another mental exercise with you regarding scheme of structuring of universe. And I'll begin to think about, for instance, I always find social insights that seem to accrue to terminal information such as I'm giving you. We do find out what is the optimum, that the sphere gets then to be the optimum for compression. And the tension going unlimited to no cross section at all. And this is really the whole scheme of our universe. That is our gravitational interaction. I find then, for instance, it is very interesting that in the regeneration of human life, the general design of the human beings of the female and the male. I find the female having then the eggs within her, and the eggs are fertilized within her, that the new life of the female continually comes out of the females. She opens up and a new life comes out of that life, and a new life comes out of that life. This is not dissimilar. In fact, it is the same principle that was discovered by Goethe, the German poet, scientist, very much of an expert in a number of scientific subjects. He was the first to point out that vegetation, that the tree, is a wave phenomenon. I'm going to bring together several things now that Goethe did not, but you and I can put together from the experiences we've already had in this room, where we came to the discovery of a tetrahedron being the simplest structural system in the universe. I want you to think now about, for instance, a Greek column. Now think about putting this piece of stone on a lathe and revolving it in order to get it round. They had different tricks of making them round. So the top of the column is the same diameter disc as the bottom of the column. I'm talking about only one piece of that stone. Now the fact is, that stone has very high compressive capability. We found it had 50,000 pounds to the square inch. Supposing now 50,000 pounds, that is 25 tons. I'd like to carry a 25-ton load. And I have a great section of a column, one piece of stone, it's a cylinder of stone. And I find that what I can do is to have a load of 25 tons. So if I just mark off in the center of the top of the cylinder a 1-inch diameter, area that has 1 square inch, then I'm going to take that stone from that top and then going down to its base, I can keep shearing off till I get a cone of stone, and at the top there, enough cross-section to take care of the 25 tons. All the rest of it gets stronger and stronger, but because it has heat in the base, it is stable, as the tetrahedron is. It's 3-point landing. It's very important. You've got to think about that one. If I have this standing by itself, it tips over like that. If I have two of them standing, they can tip over towards each other. They might tip anyway, but I'd let them tip towards each other. And if I do that, I wish I had another stick. I'm going to just do it with my arms. Here's a column and another column on my knees, and they fall towards each other. Now they have two points on the ground. They act like a hinge. They can fall this way, that way, but only in a plane. Before, they could fall any direction. Now they can only fall, articulate in a plane. Now I'm going to have a third column. Three of them are loose like that. Two of them fall together, and the third one fell towards them, and suddenly they come together and get that tripod. And for the first time, we have stable. We cannot have the stability until there are the three of them. Those are then the three legs like that for Eden. But they, as you load them, they want the thrust to come apart. So you find they have a tension, three tension members are a finite or closure. You must actually close the ring at the bottom, and they can't come apart anymore. So we have the three compression thrusts and the three tensions keeping them thrusting. So we have in that stone cone now, I have enough compressive strength for the 25 tons, which is a whole lot. That's a big 25-ton truck, very big truck. And we can carry it, and I simply chisel well over the rest of the stones on this side. The base was wide enough then to give me that three-point stability. So it's a cone, and I find I can go even further. I pick 3 points on the base, 120 degrees apart, and I can then massage away, cut away the cones and less than maybe a tetrahedron. And I have all the stability and all the compressive strength. You find it gets down to a tetrahedron. Now, the Greek column, they realize, in a sense, empirically, that's deep in with you. And human beings, just fooling around with sticks and coming to tripods and so forth, they did long ago, and campfires and so forth, what they can do with pieces of wood, handy twigs. Then there's a necessity from time to time for the load that you're going to carry is more than just that 25 tons, so you want a wider section. So we really can get that with an octahedron. Remember, the tetrahedron then had a beautiful wide base for its stability this way, but the octahedron has an equal triangle at the top. So if we had a full load, which we want to be use this much as a cross section, we use the octahedron and then to take care of both, because then we find the octahedron a very interesting set of conditions. Here's a load, these two have fallen towards each other, you have all those set of hinges in there. And everything is in optimum position of comfort about the thrust, so that we really have two cones or two point to point producing this kind of instability. Now, I want to introduce then the stabilization of columns and the tetrahedron and give you a little feeling about, as I said, the poet Gibbon introducing wave phenomena into concept in a tree, and Goethe didn't talk about the tetrahedron, but I point out to you that if we all trees grow, there was actually then the top of the tree of this year, and we have the cambium lower. So each one is a cone around. So the next year is a cone on the outside of that cone, series of cones. And in fact, we find that if you still could pair away, and the tree does, many of the trees you'll find is literally the tetrahedron there. There's three main roots going out like that, and there's three facets here coming really to a cone. So the next year is a little larger tetrahedron on top of it, and another tetrahedron on top of it. We then get to where the branches are also tetrahedral, have something called the wing root. And the bottom of the wing, you have the 2 points at the top of the hinge part, and then the member coming down to the bottom, and the wing root. It's just a tetrahedron, 1 point down and two on the top for the hinge. As is wing root of all great branches of trees. So we have a cone coming out from the cone. So we have coming out of this total surface here, the cambium layer, suddenly breaks open into a new tetrahedron going out of this branch. And on that branch, breaks open a new tetrahedron again, keeps opening up. The inside is coming out, and it gets to be a twig. And then on the end of that twig, you see the butt. and the bud keeps opening up and the leaves coming out, and out of it comes then the blossom. And then suddenly the blossom gets fertilized, there's a fruit. Finally, out of the fruit comes a seed, and finally it goes off. But Goethe pointed out this whole thing is a wave thing, opening from inside out. I want to bring back then, I spoke about the female, and the new life is on the inside, continually coming out, and the new life comes out of the next female. It's a continual opening up wave. I've also then pointed out to you the difference between the male and the female. The male then becomes discontinuous. He comes islanded. He's a hunter. The female and her young, so forth, are in great continuity, that family. But the male goes off to be the hunter, the fighter. He's the islanded. She is central. It's really very fundamental in social behavior. How I just personally find that the woman is tensive. Just fundamentally, just the act, the sex act. She pulls in, and the man is compressive. He thrusts, she pulls. And so it's very fundamental what we call being female is to pull, to warp away, to attract. Find the male tending to do this, to punch. She does the other way. I can't help but find it very important to notice these things this way. I don't see any pure males or pure females in human beings. Often males can be quite attractive as well. They do have the attraction. But the point is that there seems to be a predominant of this kind, and has something to do with the great integrities of the fundamental complementarity I gave you yesterday, where we only just learned in our last less than 20 years, less than a score of years, that the complementarity is dissimilar. It is not mirror image. The unity is plural, and at minimum two, I began to find to be a very fundamental way of thinking. And that was a phrase I began to adopt long, long ago. And I was told at the time of World War II, when the Manhattan Project came along and physics was trying to understand a great deal, that my use of the phrase unity is plural and at minimum two was then ventured into by the quantum physicists, and they found it suddenly opening up all the doors. They had to get in their fundamental tumors. You are experiencing a sense of the incredible interrelatedness of our total experience. And yet the apprehending, comprehending, incisive comprehending of the differential of the intercomplementations. I'm going to go a little more into that tensegrity and think about it. I find it's been extremely interesting to me in my experience with structures and humanity and their building, that the only reason that geodesic domes do what they do, as they get enormous spans that we've not been able to get into before, the largest clear spans of man have been way transcended by the geodesics. And they can go on to any size because they are tensionally coherent. And compression is discontinuous in the fundamental principle of the structuring itself. So that tension has no limit to size, just as we can have the interrelationship of the galaxies at the millions and billions of light years even apart, and still have the tensile integrity. So there's no limit to size of tensegrity structures. All the engineering of society built then on brick is entirely compressional strategy. Engineering has taught, structural engineering has taught, is a compressional strategy. And it is thought in the terms of the earth being a compressional unit. You dig a hole in the earth and you take a solid compression column and you put it down the hole and you fill the earth in again. Now you simply have sort of formalized compressional extension. And you find that mass that is standing there can also, that if you can hold the end of it, as the wind will, acts like a lever and can pry it loose. So what man then did, having developed a compressional continuity of the earth and a compressional column, he then took tension stays, a minimum of three, and suddenly found they could offset the wind with that tensional member making our friend the tripod an intention. Find then men building boats, so they had a solid, they thought of the boat as a solid compression continuity. They stepped the mast and they then put tension stays. Compression is primary and tension is secondary, a helper. The mast will stand up all right by itself, but if you're going to really put wind loads, take great wind loads in your sail, then you have to have the tension stays to give it greater advantage. So the enormous number of those stays at every level in the great square riggers, you see, set of stays making short mast sections, because between the sets of stays is a full column length. As you look at square riggers, then you begin to feel the tension and compression logic that I've been giving to you. Now, in thinking about then the engineering that I have experienced, where there have been a number of large buildings to be built with geodesics, and all of them have to, if they're big buildings, they all have to be processed by engineers. I have to bring in consulting engineers who are certified for that particular purpose, and I've been able to get some extremely good ones in Boston, Cambridge. And they've gone through a great many buildings with them. And we have to then go through building departments and meeting with the engineers who check the work that's going to be installed. But the engineering logic then requires a complete, pay no attention to anything but a compressional continuity. As I said, tension can be a helper, but it's a compressional logic. It is not a tensional logic with compression as local helper. Which is the way the universe is put together, both microcosmically and macrocosmically. The engineers who work with me now really finally come to realize that the 10-segment structure is the explanation of the geodesics. It's not in the engineering teaching as yet. It's not in any of the codes. It cannot be participated in. This made me realize I can get into very much lighter buildings. But I wanted to get the engineers into a strategic position to be able to take advantage of the tensegrity. And I have recently written a paper. Here's the paper that I think will greatly help, because we can go over to another form of engineering, which is called pneumatic engineering, hydraulic engineering. Some fundamental qualities now that we're going to find again regarding structures and our minimum or basic structural systems of the universe of yesterday. I want you to think now of tetrahedron again, our friend tetrahedron. I'm going to take two tetrahedra. There could be an octahedron and a tetrahedron. They could maybe join something like that. I could have them, two of them. This is the hinge. This would be a universal joint. As long as there's enough, some kind of pull between them, there's a mass attraction, so they can't come apart. So it acts very universally. Now I have a hinge, it could only do this. Three of them touching each other, now it becomes rigid for the first time. Linus Pauling, great chemist, received the Nobel Prize twice, once a Peace Prize, but the first time was as a chemist. And Linus Pauling's Nobel laureate paper reviews a history of chemical structures, with chemical structures. And he goes back to the first one of the chemists who had noted certain, just like the early human beings holding the five lights in the sky, behave a little differently from the others. We have chemists then noticing in organic chemistry certain things going on where there seemed to be an abundance of numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 in relative proportion to the way things are associating, disassociating. A man, Frankland, a relatively short time ago, just at the end of the 18th century, and early in the 19th century, we then have Kekulé and Cooper, and they make a little more of a discovery of the relation to that oneness, two-ness, three-ness, and four-ness. Then there comes a Russian scientist operating in France named Biplerev. Biplerev was the first to ever use the words chemical structure, and he related them to the oneness, two-ness, three-ness, and four-ness. And he spoke about these as bonds, and being in France, the bonds, it was a valence. And there was single valence, univalent, and bivalent, and trivalent, and quadrivalent. Now this valency, then incidentally, there was a 35-year hiatus, no more progress in chemical structures after Lippert, when suddenly a man named Franz Hoff, a Dutchman, came along, and he said he thought that the oneness, two-ness, three-ness, and four-ness had to do with the tetrahedrons, four points and four faces. He was called by all the chemists and other scientists charlatan, a rogue. He called every horrid name you could call a human being. And he was not daunted. He went on and he was able to give optical proof of the tetrahedral configuration of carbon as the first chemist in history to receive the Nobel Prize. Now, we have then the tetrahedron suddenly entering into our chemistry here and our phenomenon of bonds and valences. So I simply give you then, this would be univalent, this is bivalent, trivalent, of all four of them together, the two tetrahedrons nesting in one another, congruent with one another, and that's quadrivalent. And really the difference between a carbon, I gave you yesterday, I took the vector equilibrium, turned it into four tetrahedra, congruent with one another, do you remember? It was quadrivalent, and it's like the difference between carbon, soft carbon, and carbonous diamond. When it gets to the quadrivalent. We have then, I mentioned yesterday, in the grand synergetic strategies of the known behavior of the whole, the known behavior of some of the parts, finding about others, and going through the Greek triangle, and then Euler's beautiful topology, then I said Willard Gibbs introducing in chemistry the phase rule where he has then a relationship between chemistry in its liquid, its crystalline, its gaseous state. And we found that Willard Gibbs' phase rule had to do somewhere in the same, looked like the same kind of a formula as Euler's. This plus this equals this plus two. I then give you that the liquids, I want to go in the gases. I'm going to take the number of tetrahedra, the same size like this, and I'm going to fasten the tetrahedra together corner to corner. So this tetrahedron touches one another. And then the next corner here goes another tetrahedron. They're continually interlinked as each tetrahedron touches one other, each corner touches just one other corner. If you do that and make a model, you find there's a whole lot of space in between them. And they will flop around as a total aggregate and they will fold into one another. They act very much the way, these are the way gases. Gases are highly compressible. There's an interlinkage, there is a viscosity, there's an integrity, but it's highly compressible. But the gases distribute their loads due to the flexibility. All loads are immediately distributed. So they have air in a tire, or air in a balloon, or air in a football. And just punch it one place, and that air immediately distributes the load to all of the tensile enclosure, absolutely evenly. So a great truck can have only very few pounds of pressure in the air inside because it distributes it so perfectly to the whole load. And the bigger the casing, then the more tensile surface it distributes to. So we find then pneumatics consist of these univalences. I'm going to say take the tetrahedra and fasten each one to another tetrahedron, but two of them touching, the hinge between them. We find each one of these tetrahedron. And here, the tetrahedron here, are touching another tetrahedron at two points. They are edge to edge with to one another. Here's a tetrahedron in here, and it's edge to edge with this tetrahedron here. When you do then, when it edge to edge, then it fills all space this way and seems to be very stable. This is exactly like the liquids. The liquids are non-compressible. They already in the form of the closest packing, so it can't be compressed any further. But because they are hinged together, the hinges transmit loads. So liquids transmit any load at any one point is, as with the pneumatics, distributed to all of the tensile system. Then when we get to trivalent, then for the first time, there's no hinging, no universal joint, they're absolutely rigid. They no longer distribute loads. Now these are the fundamental qualities. The crystalline just absolutely rigid, does not distribute loads. The liquids distribute the loads. The gases distribute loads. But the gases are compressible and the liquids are not. This brings about a very important way to think. But I've got you now thinking about a tree as a set of tetrahedra coming out of tetrahedra as basic structures. But also then, to find what makes a tree able to do what trees can do. If you ever try to pick up any great weight, say, let's take a 30 or 40 pound suitcase, and you try to hold it out horizontally, and you still find you can't do it. And yet you'll find a tree holding out a branch, and some of these branches, if you weigh them, get up to as much as 5 tons. And able to hold out 5 tons horizontally in a great wind and yield to the wind and not break off, it's fantastic structural capability. Man's never done anything like it before. Well, it's done by a very simple way, because nature then has, in the crystalline, you have triple bond, therefore you have the greatest tension. The liquids have two bonds, they're a little more viscous, more tensile strength than the gases, only one bond, the compound. So that the greatest tensile strength is accomplished by the crystalline. Therefore, nature ships in a seed the instructions for further crystal production. And you can produce the local crystals with the local waters and atmospheres and the local chemistries. So these crystals grow, and the crystals actually send sacks for liquid. And so the tree is just filled with the liquid. I gave you yesterday the tree also having to have roots so that it could not blow away when exposing all that leafage to take on the sun energy impoundment through photosynthesis. So that we had osmosis, and the water comes, it goes only one way, valving, profile of the roots into the tree to fill all these sacks. So the tree is using this, the crystalline entirely in tension to enclose the liquids. And the liquids then completely distribute the loads throughout the tree. They valve it out in the sky, just bit by bit, to turn it into more rain to come back, and more trees to fill more of this process can go on elsewhere. But the water is entrapped in there, therefore it distributes its load locally. So there's then this absolute non-compressibility of the liquid, and distributing loads make that tree able to do this extraordinary task. We get an ice storm, off comes the branch. It can no longer, comes crystalline, cannot distribute its load. Men have not built any buildings in that way. It is entirely, it's that crystalline continuity concept of compression on compression. So as yet, our building is incredibly inefficient. And so I'm now trying to understand a little about what goes on in tensegrity structures. And I will come then to the analogy with hydraulics and pneumatics, the load distributing, because we do have continuous tension and discontinuous compression. I want you to think about what goes on inside a sphere when you blow it up. Let's say it's a basketball, be a balloon. You keep introducing more air. There are then molecules of the gases, and you're getting them crowded in there. Now, all these gases are full of fundamental kinetics. They continually going like this. Remember, every action having its reaction and resultant. So every little molecule of gas that is going somewhere in there does it by shoving off from another molecule going the other way. Think about two swimmers. You probably have done swimming in a tank, all right, and you dive and you get the other end and you double up your knees and shove off from there for the wall, come out again. But two swimmers can meet in the middle of the tank and shove off each other's feet, like that, double up, and then off they go, using the other one's inertia. This would be typical of the way molecules are behaving in pneumatic structures. Now, we find that the molecules then are not simply going, they don't go to the center of the sphere and then explode outwardly. This would be a pulsative affair, take time for them to get in, and the thing would be vibrating like that. They're not doing that. They are ricocheting around inside. So each one is starting to go this way, another one goes that way, and the two hit the wall. And they can't go any further. They push the wall outwardly, and then they bounce, ricochet off, and hit the wall again. So they're acting like little cords inside of the sphere. Now, also then introduce another principle, which is dealing in great circles and spheres. And the word geodesic. Geodesic means the most economical relationship between events, between any two events. The great circles on spheres are geodesics. As a shorter distance between any two points in the sphere on the great circle than it is on any of the lesser circles. A great circle is defined as a line formed in the sphere by a plane going through, cutting through the center of the sphere. The equator is just such. Each of the planes of longitude go through the center of the sphere. So those are great circles. I want you to, we have then on here also lesser circles. We have the latitudes. They're not great circles. We come up here to 80 degrees north latitude. I'm going to take my dividers and open from the pole to the 80 latitude. And I find that I strike this little circle. I get my dividers fixed in that opening, and I go down to the equator and put it down here and strike the same circle. So we have then the equator running like this and the circle superimposed on it. Where the little circle, the lesser circle, crosses the big circle at A and B. You find it's much shorter distance between A and B on the equator than it is going off the detour of 90 degrees and then coming back this way. I just want you to visualize quickly that how great circles are most economical between points on spheres, and the chords of great circles are even more economical. So we find that the molecules bouncing around inside the sphere will not go around in latitudes or lesser circles. They just automatically have to get into bouncing in the great circles. That becomes very exciting to discover. So they're not just going around in layers. If they're going around in layers like this, this whole thing is flattened down very easily that way. And it has all this omnidirectional stability due to the fact that it is using great circles. Now I get one great circle around here. And we find that every great circle crosses every other great circle at two points. So that this great circle longitude crosses then the other longitudes at the north and south pole, always 180 degrees apart. I got a great circle here and another great circle there. Then I got suddenly a third great circle, the equator. And that makes a triangle. North pole, equator, equator. Now we found two is unstable. And something I didn't say to you yesterday about the necklace and the triangle that I'd like to introduce right now because it's very, very relevant to the understanding about that triangle. I said, why and how did that necklace consisting of three compression members, rigid and three flexible tension corners, how and why did it stabilize its pattern? I find that any two of them coming together are fastened one to the other. They're like a pair of two knives or a pair of scissors with a common fulcrum, a lever. And the further you go out on the lever arm, the more effective those shears are. Therefore, if you want to have a bolt cutter, you can come way out very long arms of good strong steel. So we find that each side of a triangle, compression member, is taking hold of the ends of two levers, and with minimum effort, because they're down the end of the lever, stabilizing the opposite angle. It's really very exciting to see how beautiful, again, this least effort that is being demonstrated by that necklace triangle. Coming back then to triangles and understanding it, is the third side that stabilizes the opposite angle. So I had two great circles crossing each other at an unstable angle at the pole there. But then the equator crosses it, triangulates it and immediately stabilizes because we have these interference patterns going on here, and this sets up a triangle. Then the fact that there's one triangle, then you find that automatically then makes, I said I had the equator and I had these two here, and then suddenly get the octahedron shows up. It automatically makes the octahedron. So I get four triangles, eight triangles here. And these triangles, even though the first two may have been some odd angle like that, not full 90 degrees, and the second is where the equator crossed, maybe not, but because there's a very high frequency interference there, they keep trying to average. They're whipped back towards the octahedron. We find then this same thing happens with the icosahedron. where we have six great circles instead of the three of the octahedron. And these six great circles, here they are. And they, here are the triangles, where you can see them getting to the point they can't get any closer to the triangle, you can't go that way any further, and you can't go the other way. Because here is a triangle up here. See this triangle? And this triangle down here. And these have gone spreading to the center of each of the center of gravity, each of those triangles. All the variables are in there. These would then represent the ways in which, I said, the icosa gave you the most volume with the least energy investment. So again, this least effort. We find then fundamentally the molecules of gas inside of a pneumatic structure get to doing exactly the pattern you're looking at here. This thing you're looking at incidentally is called in the British Museum the oldest toy known to man. This particular one came from Rangoon, and through the Thailand and Rangoon, these are used instead of pneumatic balls, and they play and they hit the balls, and this bounce beautifully, distributes those incredibly beautifully. So now I have here a very fascinating matter, because I found that the pneumatic structures are producing icosahedral great circle interaction patterns. This hit me very hard, and because it was a pure geodesic structure, and I received a ladder and some photographs from two scientists at General Dynamics quite a few years ago, and they were two scientists who were working on re-entry cone problems for the rocketry and space vehicles. And you get in this enormous heat of re-entry, the frictions and so forth. They were trying to get into that. They were making experiments with titanium, which is where we know, you know, we get the greatest lightness and very, very high strength. And they made two hemispheres of sheet titanium. One about a half inch less in radius than the other, or in other words, an inch less in diameter. They had one concentric with the other. And they sealed up the base between the two, so there was a half inch space between these two hemispheres. Then, with a pneumatic pump, the vacuum pump, they pulled out the air existing between the two thin shells. This meant that the bottom, the inside, the smaller shell, the atmosphere was able to get inside of it. And it came coming inside of it, it then pushed the inner sphere outwardly, because the atmosphere came inside the sphere and pushed it out. But they exhausted the air between the two, therefore the same atmosphere on the outside of the outer sphere pushed it in. And it dimpled in under absolute distant pattern, the pure icosahedron. And they found that the what we call the frequency of the modular subdivision depended on the relative thickness of the metal. If we made the metal thinner, we got higher and higher frequency, 10-sequity icosahedral geodesics. They thought I'd be pretty pleased with it. And of course it was. Now, what I'm coming to then, the way we really explain geodesic structures must be hydraulically rather than as crystalline, because the crystalline structures do not distribute their loads, and these do. The very beauty of it being the fact that as I say, if you tense any one of them, they'll come out the same tuning all over. Next, we've got quite a lot of interconnection here today. Begin then to think of a universe in which there are great potentials for humanity, and we immediately have great insights that man is then accomplishing tasks he needs to do, building such a ruin here today, looking at great cities, where I now know that, actually experimentally, that I can give you 300 buildings for one for the tasks they have to do against the best known ultimate engineering strategy than just the one thing, 10-sequity spherical structures, where spheres in their own right enclose the most volume with the least surface. You have to pay attention. Now, I hope, and I'm saying this right now in our meeting, because I want you to begin to feel with me as we explore more and more. You find openings all around with problems that have been, you know that are facing humanity. If you can see there are options and outs that he's not employing. and you begin to add up those options and outs that it's not employing, you suddenly discover it's highly feasible to take care of all humanity at a higher standard than anybody's ever known. And I know, and this is when I'm talking about big planets, little man on our planet, not working on cosmic accounting, but having started naked, helpless, ignorant, finding his way by trial and error, is still at a level, sort of average error of viewpoint, which is perfectly logical. There's no bad or good man in here. You can't get anywhere in your thinking if you impute malevolence to individuals and so forth. I find then that it is then still assumed by humanity as self-evident that there's nowhere nearly enough life support to go around. So people are always worrying about that population of people are in, worrying about all the other people coming around to jeopardize their peaceful stability or enjoyment of their advantage. We have then, because it's a working assumption there's nowhere nearly enough to go around, this is why we have politics. Each political and politics are inherently biased. They simply say there's nowhere nearly enough ground, but I have the most logical and fairest way of coping with fundamental inadequacy. It's a horrible matter. But if you come along with me, you're going to get a better chance of carrying on, and your family have a better chance of surviving. That's the only reason I have politics. And you're automatically taking an absolute lethal bias, it's going to be your side or the other side. Gratifying man could do a little more, so he said, well, you and I get together, apparently both of us can get on all right, so get a little larger groupings. And all of humanity finally, enormous blocks of now possibly three or four major groups saying, that's for you and me. But beginning out even two great big ones, you and me. And for this reason, we do have then the great nations of the earth annually. For the last two decades, United States, China, Russia, NATO alone, their appropriations annually sum total more than $200 billion a year, getting ready to kill. All the highest capabilities of man being focused on how do you kill. I'm under working assumption there's never enough to go around for everybody. Therefore, there's no use in having social legislation. If there's no expenditure you can make, you're going to take care of everybody. So you don't try to spend it that way. I don't know why politics can sometimes seem to be so cruel in not taking care of the poverty. We say, there's just not enough. I now know, I really know very well, and I'm sure when you finish with me, you'll go out and do a lot of checking, but you will have got many, many insights in the direction where what you could see what I'm saying could be true. I'll just give you something very simple in the relation then to that structure and environment controlling, man developing environment controls for humanity, where you don't want to have something as an insulator, you want to have a prison, you don't want to have that Greek sphere and there's no traffic between the two. You want to have some kind of environment control through which what you need can come through when you want it. It's a sieve. Must be a valve to then not try to insulate you. You need water to drink, but you can't drink it all in rain. So you want to have a holding pattern where you then interrupt, shut, and hold, and valve into your presence in the magnitudes and frequencies that correspond with our needs, while also being utterly thoughtful of the rest of the ecological balance of all the other things that have to go on if life's going, if human beings are going to go on. So that water can be very, very well handled. And just a holding pattern, because gravity is pulling this. So just don't let it move that fast. You run it through all the useful channels necessary. So I see then, environment controlling is a valving phenomenon in which we have things coming at us in all directions. Like to have an omnidirectional environment valve that can cope with the various frequencies and magnitudes of the various of all the things we want to intercept and turn to advantage. It's a very different way of talking from the old architecture, something that's going to give you distinction out on Main Street, or maybe something you're going to make money out of. We're talking about how do you make life work and trying to find out why humans are here and what we ought to be doing to abet why we're here and how we employ the principles we're discovering in the most effective manner. I think it's a good time for a break. So I talked about the grand strategies of all political systems, assuming it has to be you or me, and the enormous commitment towards the negative of the killing, and really opposite of synergetic, it is really me or you, rather than realizing there could be something when you and I get together. It doesn't make any such allowance. And I'm also gradually exposing to you grand strategies of nature's way of solving problems, showing that she has principles of operating in the universe, that she always does things the most economical, she uses the most efficient, and you and I, having been born naked and helpless and finding our way, doing many inefficient things as we go, simply because we do have a prime built-in drive of hunger, procreative urge, thirst, curiosity, all these built-in, we're giving this program so that we'll do it. I say, quite clearly designed to make those mistakes, but also then designed to be able to discover principles and to discover that you can be more efficient and nature is using most economical. So that as we begin to get a little closer to nature, which unquestionably means that getting considerably happier, that we're going to find ourselves getting considerably more efficient. And I just want to be aware of that as I talk, when I talk about the biggest kind of patterns. I introduced to you yesterday the idea that nature is doing some very big things, and that society didn't know were going to happen. I've introduced you to society having a vanity, and once it's happened, not really having the beautiful lesson it really could learn if it realized how completely it did not anticipate that. Therefore, society would not be assuming it was having to find all the answers right away, that to realize the universe is getting along pretty well, and we may be able to check in. We may become members of the operating system where we begin to really consciously participate, employing our higher faculties to really get on with the universe. We may have such a function ahead, but we have not qualified yet. We're an embryo, and I'd like you to keep feeling that as we go along. Also, then, I'd like you to keep thinking about, on your own part, your own life, what you begin to feel you might do with the information that I'm finding you can do things more efficiently, more effectively. What could you do to contribute to the total evolution of humanity and getting them ready to operate competently in a high function in the universe by helping each individual to a higher advantage, to be more efficient, be spontaneously more efficient, make it logical to be more efficient, to be joyful, more efficient. The more we really learn about big patterns, then the more comprehensive we are, and the more we learn how these patterns operate, the more we can really anticipate how we can take advantage of the principles that are operative to bring them to advantage of humanity, to try to make humanity a success, trying to make the whole ecological system a success, to begin to participate in what apparently nature is always doing, eternally regenerating. I finally have to use these words, comprehensive, anticipatory, design, science. I gave you science as setting order the facts of experience. I can give you design as against the happening to you, where you do it deliberately, where using principles and employing order, we try to anticipate the needs of humanity, anticipate the needs of nature in general, try to anticipate the accommodation of total intercomplementarity. And using these principles then to actually begin to participate in the evolutionary formulations of nature, where we don't just have to wait, have to take it for granted that somebody else is going to provide these things for us, somebody else is going to invent, that each one of us has an increasing intuition, an obligation to employ these principles in an effective manner on behalf of all of humanity and on behalf of the total integrity of the universe itself in its eternal regeneration. I am obviously deliberately thinking about my strategies, and I'm operating entirely intuitively and spontaneously, and I'm really looking around to see if there's anything that I feel that just small points to make before going to another large scene. I'm now going to do a little reviewing of, as I did yesterday, what is it that I'm conscious of when I say I'm thinking. I'm now going to come down to, I said, if we try to find one word, just one word alone, that identifies our experience of phenomena called life, I'd say the number one word would be awareness. And I then also say, no otherness, no awareness. This has to be something to be aware of. I find this very, very fundamental. and it relates very much to the complementarity. And the otherness would be not exactly the same, could bring about a tendency to differentiate as observer from the observed. I find it fascinating to think about awareness and say, no otherness, there's nothing to look at, there's nothing to sense. There would be no life under those circumstances. I want to think about a rather simple model here of, I'm going to have an entity and I'm going to make it a spherical entity at the moment. It's an islanded entity, and there's no aberration of forces operating on it, so it tends to be spherical. And there is otherness, but it's for the moment not aware of it. Gradually, suddenly, there's mass into attractiveness, and then anotherness gets attracted. So we have another sphere being pulled towards the sphere. And there's this sort of aware that something is different than light that you're experiencing, something going on here. I think it'd be different. There's no shadow or anything for the moment. I don't have any source of light. But this otherness and its mass attraction, because the two spheres finally come as close as they can together, the tangent, and begin roll around in one another. I seen, if you and I could see this from a distance, it looked like a dumbbell. It's just two spheres tangent. You would not know whether they're rolling on each other or not. But you and I know, if we take two spheres and put that, they just can roll around each other very, very readily. Now, a third otherness is in the universe, and it gets attracted to the first two. And it is a third sphere, and it comes in. I just take a couple of spheres, you get this feeling. Just want to get a feel of these, how they can roll around in each other. And now there's a third sphere that gets attracted. And it comes to touch one of these and gets rolled around on it, and it gets into the valley between the two. Now it's suddenly equally attracted by both. And suddenly we have a triangle. And triangle, remember, has basic structure. So this has extraordinary stability. No longer can they roll anywhere around here, because we find, I'm sure you've had experience with gears. You have two gears of the same diameter, same number of teeth, and the part you have one turning clockwise and they mesh, and the other one's turning counterclockwise. They go along very nicely. If we have four gears, touching the train of gears, are called positive and negative, or positive and negative, everything just goes great. But if I have odd numbers of gears, three for instance, these two can be going like that. But then the one that comes in touch with you can't gratify both directions, going this way and that way, and they lock. When we have odd numbers of gears in a train, they lock. So we find these three spheres can no longer just roll around here. But the one thing they can do, notice this one touches two others here. So it can roll in that valley like that, rolling around here. What happens is that if this one does something, there's a friction here and makes the other one do it. So fine, all three of them begin to, like a rubber donut, they evolve like that. They can do that very well. So the top is evolving outwardly and the bottom is turning inwardly. So I just saw kind of like a rubber donut can keep going around. Now a fourth sphere appears in the universe. And it doesn't make a difference exactly what size it is. And it lands on here and rolls around here and gets this valley, and then something goes in the nest between the others. And once that fourth one is there, it locks it so it can no longer evolute involute. So suddenly we find the four spheres making the tetrahedron again, and suddenly it is structurally stable as the four interact to offset any any other freedoms of motion here. Just fun. I was asked about 8 years ago to go to University of California at Los Angeles for that, having the art departments of all of University of California branches along the coast annually choose one of them where they'll have an art festival they all come together at. I was asked to the art festival at Los Angeles, and they asked me, after having had a lecture, they want to have a happening. So we went, and they got a big field house, and I brought a great many spheres, the styrofoam spheres, skewers, toothpicks, and rope, string. And I started by having this in universe. It doesn't see any other than this. It doesn't even know what it's doing. It's running around. It was running around the floor of this thing like this, with one of the balls. And the other one appears, and they get together, and have three, and then four of them locked together. It was a little child of a couple of the four, about 2 years old. And this child saw me do this and ran out from the parents, out on the floor, and I was running around all these balls. And the little child started picking them up and doing exactly the same things. It was really very interesting. This little two-year-old had found just what I was doing to be just the way his own curiosity made it behave. And after the show was over, NBC had a team of cameramen and directors and so forth, and they said, "We've been waiting till this is over, so we want to make a movie picture of you." And I said, "Did you take that picture, the episode of that little child?" I said, "Of course not." And I said, "Well, you've got to make any picture of me." I'll just give you an idea of my feeling about recordings, because I do care about the live and the way things really do happen. And I care a great deal about the way things go on in this room right here now. Now, I'm going to point out that I was dealing here in spheres, and when I did a tetrahedron before, I had some points, and the four points had inter attractiveness, and they did give me a system. They defined an insideness and outsideness. But we really come out things a little different way here. And then I can also, finding there's really sort of fundamental to-ness, I could really have had this sphere and this sphere could interconnect, and this sphere could interconnect. And these spheres are just a little too large for my hands, that's the trouble. I'm going to have to... Now, take two spheres and two spheres. They're touching each other, the pairs, the dumbbells. What I'm going to do is to bring them together, not to make a square, but we have precession. The inner pull makes this precess, actually makes it rotate 90 degrees, and suddenly these two then nest on these two. And if you look at the tetrahedron made of, you've got two pairs of spheres, and there's a positive and a negative pair that really do this to each other. And they do this precessioning. We'll learn later on that this is very important, this precessional association, things come together rotatively like that. Now, I'm going to also then come back to something I did talk a little about yesterday, that the six edges of the tetrahedron as acting, the six represented one unit of quantum, these six vectors. And I made an experiment with my own personal body in relation to degrees of freedom. Being brought up in a good community, I'm in a good school, and I learned considerable about physics and so forth, chemistry. I was very intrigued by the concept of the interattractiveness of the masses and so forth. And I said that also as I got into navigation in the Navy. If I'm looking at something like the Pleiades or looking at Andromeda, it's approximately just one little point. But you learn that that's a whole constellation. You're looking at incredible numbers of stars. But they're so far away that they appear to be one star. And thinking about then mass interattraction, so what I said, I say it's pulling me. I don't think each of those stars separately, a billion stars in there are pulling on me separately. They really would be, they're so far away that parallax sets in and they really, in fact, only one pull. We do have then in astronomy this phenomenon of parallax, and then it's continually operative where things do pair together. But I said, I wonder how many lines are pulling on me and the universe. They're always pulling on our Earth a little more so, but how many are pulling on me, or even, say, pulling on our Earth? Are they, are each one of those stars that pulling separately, or do they group up, possibly, in the pulls? And due to the fact that they're non-simultaneous, possibly the interpullings do integrate in some extraordinary kind of timing way of coming from different periods of time. So I said, let me think about, I'm going to look at those stars, and I look out, and I see a hole in the stars, some place where which I might, when I accelerate, I might go out and get away from all the stars, and I go further and further away from all the stars, and they finally just get look like one. But there still would be mass and attraction. So I would be very much as if, like a ball on a string, like we call a tether ball. We have a mast and a string and a tennis ball on there, and you can hit it. And that ball can go all kinds of ways. But the one thing it can do is get away from the universe. So there's just one restraint on us. But you can find it, because you make all kinds of shapes, spheres, all kinds, describe anything else. And I'm going to say, I don't think experience has suggested to me that we really will find the holes with those stars, because I find when I get to the billion times 100 billion stars that surround us, that we now know of already. If I were to take the numbers of atoms in this room surrounding me, here would be, and there's pretty thick walls, to get into that kind of number. So that I probably wouldn't find any hole out in the stars. So much more likely that I might be able to take all the stars in the heavens and divide it, like looking, there is the Milky Way. I might take two halves of all the stars and sort of divide them into two teams, so they pulled on me kind of evenly. So I took my ball that had a string, and I put another string on it. And I fastened, got you to take a hold of one, and I take the other. And so the ball's in the middle of it. It's like a ball in the middle of a violin string. It can still move, but it can only move in a plane. You make figures of eight and cloverleafs and so forth, and in a plane. So I said, I don't think I really can divide those stars up even in that way. The more probably, I have to get more teams. I'm going to take three pulls on me. So I took a third string on this other, the ball is in the middle between you and I. You take the third string and you pull it over there. Now I find it can still move, but it's as if it's a ball in the middle of a drumhead. It can oscillate only in a line. But interesting, one restraint allowed me to have sphericity, two restraints that made me a plane, and three restraints produces a line. So then I said, I'm going to pull the drumhead one way. I put a fourth line on the ball, pull it vertically, and it suddenly seems to be immobilized, as if I muted the drum, pulling the skin just one direction. But I made a model where I made a steel tetrahedron with four corners, and had four rods, thin steel rods, come into a central ball at the center of the center of gravity of the tetrahedron. And the steel ball, and I pulled those rods tight. They were very thin, so the slenderness ratio. And I found that the ball, if I put a plumber's Stilson wrench on that ball, I could rotate it in place. I could not move it towards away from any of the four corners, but locally you could rotate it. In fact, put it on several ways and kept rotating. So it was locally rotatable. Why? Because you found that any two of these rods were coming into the surface of the sphere, they were not coming to the center of the sphere. You couldn't get the center of the sphere. You're bound as long as there's any sphere there at all. One coming like that and one in here. So it made a trapezoid. There's a distance between where they hit the sphere. And a trapezoid is unstable. It's a four-sided figure. So I found that in order to stop it from doing any rotating like that locally, I had to take each of the four rods that came in and turn each one into three rods. from four corners, and each one had to come in, these three came in tangentially, making in effect four tetrahedra coming in tangentially. And then for the first time, it could not move, so some total they found 12 rods were necessary to completely to eliminate all degrees of freedom. I wanted to confirm that in another way, so I then began to think about a bicycle and a bicycle wheel. And bicycle wheels are fascinating because bicycle wheels manifest man getting into tensegrity in his structures. The old-fashioned solid wooden wheel, that's just a number of plates, boards together like that, one thing. Then we got to get what you call artillery wheel. You found you could put holes in the solid wheel. Instead of having those holes, you could deliberately have columns, a series of columns, running between the outer rim and the hub. And the columns had to be then what you call a stout column, a short column, so they not get in the critical slenderness ratio, where they bend. So each one is a pole, like pole vaulting, as you go over the bar, they give you another bar, and they keep going along on these columns. Then they take the wire wheel, and the wire wheel is very different, because the load is the wagon, and the wagon then goes out to its spindles here in the hubs. And you want to support them at the hub. The wheel is there to do that. So in the wire wheel, you hang the load by a thin wire, which would otherwise bend with any compression on it, but you hang the load from the top of the wheel down to the hub. So if there was just one spoke, just the wheel went along, then you suddenly would, the whole thing would crash. We find then if you want to have your bicycle wheel worthwhile light, you have an awful lot of weight to pump your automobile, bicycle, so you'd like to have the wheel weigh as little as possible, so you'd like to have the rim good and thin. And the rim is a mass, it's over a bent mass going around, coming back to the south, so that what I want to do is to shorten up the unsupported length of rim. So I'm going to have a hub and one tension from the top down to the hub, and then go 120 degrees on the wheel and have another spoke over here. I've got three spokes now. They're just wire spokes to the hub. But I find they act like that drum head. They'll oscillate, the whole thing will oscillate in the wheel and completely unstable and unsteerable. But that won't do. I want to see what I could do is to, if I had two skins on a drum head and I put a spacer in between the two, then you mute it, you can put it positive and negative, so I can have six spokes now, and three come from one side of the hub, of the rim, into the hub, and three from the other side. So there's three emanating from the end of the hub, but instead of having like this, have turned like that. They then have more shorter sections of unsupported rim to stabilize it. And I found that didn't work because as the six came into the hub, again, they came in the way I shown you the circle before. They came in forming a trapezoid, so there's a little section here, and the hub could torque it locally. I found I had to take each of the six came in there and make each one into two and have each one come in the pairs tangentially, one taking care of the rotation this way and one taking care of the rotation that way. Now, it is perfectly possible to put, of those six, that I could only take two of them and cross them to take care of this torque, you say. But then you find if you do, you unbalance the wheel has to have symmetry of structuring all the way through. And if you have an oddity like just one pair across to top this, then you find that she's going to wobble like that. She'll be able to what you call dynamic instability. So that it takes a minimum of 12 spokes for a wire wheel. It took a minimum of 12 restraints to immobilize me in the universe. So I find then these seem to be the six positive and the six negative of the same our friend the tetrahedron. The tetrahedron then can, as we saw it yesterday, can turn itself inside out, and so then this is the positive and the negative side of the same tetrahedron. I gave you yesterday the dimpling in of the that this tetrahedron can turn itself inside out. If it's rubber legs, I just move one vertex. Just one vertex had to move, so the legs are rubbery, it'll do that. Then we looked at the octahedron and found the octahedron simply one half it nested back into the other half. And the icosahedron, there was a local dimpling. As we got to even larger numbers of the... I get to higher and higher frequency of triangular subdivision going beyond the icosahedron, which this does. Then you find this gets to be what I call local dimpling. And the higher the frequency, the more local the dimpling. So begin to understand then the tetrahedron turns out completely inside out, and here we're going to having less and less effect as you get the positive and the negative here of the dimpling. Now, I want you to think in largest possible context of our universe, and our universe which is continually transforming everywhere, but everywhere transforming at different rates. And I gave you the importing, exporting of energies, of the Boltzmann effect, where energies given off by this begin to form new, and there get to be new local systems in the universe, new stars, and then they begin to gradually get to the point where, instead of being, I use the word syntropic, in contradistinction to great second law of thermodynamics, entropy, entropic, where they're giving off energies, they're a place where energies are being imported, and not only imported, but sought in and put into increasing order. And now thinking about things in a very big kind of pattern, and thinking about our own, what it is you and I are experiencing. Recalling that, yes, a year ago we had the Copernicus celebration of the 500th year, since he realized that we were also on a planet, we're not in a platform in the middle of the universe with everything going around us. We've come then to the realization of the little planet. There really is, and this is very important for you, theoretically, we now know then this is a little planet of this sun, and many things that I talk about, very familiar to all of you. This is a well-known data. But I want to point out to you that also then there are these conditioned reflexes of humanity, where what we've had explanations from people who love us very much, we love them very much, and we get to being told by people who love us very much, you're going to find this very pleasant and so forth, it's going to be bad, developing all kinds of prejudices and so forth, and fixities of reflexing. I have tried, I've had the advantage of speaking to bodies of distinguished scientists on a number of occasions, and I've always ask a scientist, can raise his hand and say, most people say they see the sun setting, that they do not see the sun setting, that they see and feel the horizon of the earth to be rolling around to obscure the sun. All of them agree that they see the sun setting. And we all agree that science has known for 500 years that that's not what's going on. So I want to point out there's a complete difference between the theoretical knowledge that you have. So science and all society have greater theoretical knowledge, but the sensing is the way they reflex. And they've been told and conditioned for a very, very long time that the sun is going around the earth. And they also were thinking of they know it's a sphere today, but they find humanity still talking and thinking flat earth. It still uses wide, wide world. It's to each local person, it's still really feeling this is flat out here. And there's some I know the people in China are not upside down, but the point is, I feel this way. And because of it, it's a flat, it goes to infinity, therefore, what goes on locally is very important, and there's room to get rid of anything you don't like. A man's been operating that kind of way. There's also been powers of experience with dealing in infinity. Infinity's going to have a lot more resources to take the place of ones you've already wasted and used up. Man's been very tightly tied up to those conditional reflexes. And if you begin to go along with me during these few days here together, I want you to always be deeply aware of those conditional reflexes that are working against the man's taking advantage of the theoretical knowledge we have, because I've been going to expose you to more and more discoveries of principles that are operative that could make it possible to make a man a great success. Because I really have now taken inventory some totally of how much you need to have environmental control. We've taken inventory of how much energy we need to really carry on, enjoying, having all of humanity enjoying all the earth continually, and looking out for all the generations to come. And we find it highly feasible. But we see that humanity is tied up in patterns that do not make it very clear whether they're really going to break through, whether they're going to overcome the conditional reflexes. Maybe there's a great many older people going to have to die before we really free ourselves. That's the evolutionary rate. We find nature does have her checks and balances, and she has gestation rates. She doesn't have any immediate anything. And each one has, and the bigger ones take the longer. Most important ones take the longest. What is going the biggest way is you and I are trying to be as conscious as we can about how we participate and what are the challenges to our employing this information on behalf of the others. Now, in this kind of a big paneling, I want to today to try to think about something I mentioned 2-3 times, how and why human beings are here, why we're designed the way we are, why the biosphere and the greater ecology system is designed the way it is, and why this little tiny planet with all this great complexity on board of it is present in our universe, and why the invisible you and I are incredible complex of beautiful technology. And that's a point that you might as well think about now and think about all through my talk. That technology is then the integrity of interrelationship, interoperativeness of principles, and the ability to accommodate the transformation, and the ability to complement and to, it is a great enormous complexity of interaction of generalized principles which make possible an eternally regenerative universe, where the principles are then always characterized by these degrees of freedom. There's now known 92 regenerative chemical elements, and having discovered just in this century that each one of those chemical elements, when incandescent, we said yesterday, has a unique set of frequencies, electromagnetic frequencies they give off. These are invisible colors to you and I, invisible frequencies that we don't have the tuning capability for, but they are tunable and recognizable by photographic emulsions, so that we have been able then to identify each one of them. And we have then these incredible behaviors of incredibly high frequencies, way beyond any sensing on your part or my part. And with every one of the events of the intertransformings, there are always 6 positive, 6 negative degrees of freedom. There are an enormous number of options of nature. Because I want you to just think about that pattern. I said with every event, there are always these 6 positive, 6 negative. If I were to make a drawing of that, then this is a game of chess, but it's an omnidirectional game of chess, and every time you get a move, you get 6 moves, and it's going to be in respect to an orderly universe. So you have this move, and you can go like that, and come back where you started because you had 6. Or you could, same 6, you go like that, 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 that. It might be over here. There are an extraordinary number of varieties of consequences. With every move, you go 6. And they're not in a plane, because they can also then be this way. As a consequence of the universe, having these 6 positive, 6 negative degrees of freedom with every move, we have differentiation in positioning. And the very fact that there is differential in positioning, and then it is, in our sensing, is accommodated by this. It means then there's so many of the varieties and options of choice. Of, these are equally economical, because nature is always most economical. These are the most economical vectors. So there's the six positive, six negative, equally economical options at every event. So it's anything but a yes, no, stop, go. Man tends to think linearly that he's going to get chopped against a red light or a green light. But it's not that way at all. It has so many degrees of freedom, and the frequency at which the next move comes is so high that you can come out daisies, you can come out elephants, you can come out galaxies. This to me is incredible, that it has so much freedom. It seems to be absolutely free. There's a tendency of man then talking about sort of a free will, but he does have all his physical options. He in effect can do anything, but some of the things will take longer than others. In effect, he can do anything, but they just take longer than others. Now, here are we human beings in this kind of a pattern, and with the minds discovering those pit rules and discovering that there's a plurality and they're all interaccommodative, and that a plurality of interaccommodative behaviors are designed, that we human beings discovered that we're given the faculty to have access to some of the design of the universe itself, that we don't know any other phenomenon having this capability, makes me have to really pay a lot of attention to that human being here. I want to think a little more about those human beings. What do we know about them in relation to other living species? All other enormous number of organisms, botanical and zoological. And one thing I can say is the following, that all the other species have an evidence, very important integral equipment built into the organism, which gives special advantage in special environments. So maybe this particular kind of a vine that grows superbly in this particular area of the Amazon, what some kind of insect can do, just extraordinary little things locally in special environments, with just special equipment for it. So this very strange looking creature kind of that special equipment. So we find the bird then designed with integral wings. For his real, his métier then is the air. In gases, he can fly beautifully. But when he's not flying, he cannot divest himself of his wings. So the wings then, when he's trying to walk around, are quite encumbering. We find then all living species then having some of this integral equipment for special environments. We found a number of the creatures with brains, the way human beings have. And those brains are also sensing mechanisms, and they're feeling. And the brains, as I said yesterday, always correlating and integrating the information of the different senses. And human beings have larger brains than any of the others. They can put away and store information regarding more special case experiences than the others. But then the human has that mind. We don't have any knowledge of any other creature having that kind of phenomenon. We don't find any evidence any of the creatures are deliberately employing principles. They are flying, they're low pressure, their wing is beautifully designed for them to do it, but they have not designed it that way. But I find then that the humans are then given the capability to get enormous amounts of information, and its ability to discover principles, and to be really then very much at the center of things, where the individual then discovers the principle of pressure differentials in gases, the Bernoulli principle, about the wing foil with the pressure difference for the negative lift. And human beings then can invent wings, and they can produce those wings using other principles and alloys and so forth, able then to fly, put on wings, and fly many times faster than the bird, and then when they're not using the wings, to take them off and not be humble, and let somebody else use their wings. And wings can go from generation to generation. The same organism can be used by others. In other words, they begin to develop their own organism. We are given the capability. the broad principles and actually participate in some way in the evolutionary events of the universe. Because if we do produce these artifacts, they do alter the environmental behaviors. But we're given that capability. Now, again, I said all universe is technology. And the technology is going on all the time, and you don't know what makes your fingernail grow, but it's beautiful technology. The fact you don't know or not familiar with that technology doesn't make it non-technology. I find human beings using the word technology today as if it's something very new, and something just been introduced by man, and they find it bad. Simply because the technologies employed by man so far have, in the ignorance of man, thinking it has to be you and me, been used selfishly, trying to get special advantage from our side, and particularly in developing weapons for just the killing. But it's been used very, very negatively. This does not mean technology is bad. This hand can then do some very superb work, very advantageous to you and I, all the people here, or can do this terrible thing of killing and breaking. So it's the way human beings have used the technology that has been some inadequate and fearful, powerful conditioned reflex, misinformation, that's made human beings misuse the technology. So I want to be sure we don't get caught in any trap where we say, I'm against technology or something like that, and I'm going to go back to pre-technology. You never will. As long as there's going to be a turnip growing there, it's incredible technology. And so that simply is a matter of how do we employ it? Are we really thoughtful? Are we considerate about all the other reciprocities that have to go on ecologically? Those are things. Are we considerate when they talk comprehensive anticipatory design science? We pay attention to what the universe is trying to do. Are we conserving the universe? Are we using the income energies? Are we using the permitted? Are we really trespassing and using up some of the equipment? It's a very different matter to use the energy and use the lever rather than burning the lever up in the fire. Now, next thing. Thinking about humans having these capabilities of using principles and being really the center of things, this also brings me to a very interesting realization that human beings are being at the center is very different from being on some place, a position on a line or in a pipe. You cannot really improve on the center. And I hear people talking about possible genetics, possible bad experiments being made by scientists in trying to alter the human being. All I know is there's no way you can really improve on the center. You can, if it's linear, you can make the man go, I jump a little higher. But you cannot get closer to the center than the center. And our function is to be at the center, the information, to discover the principles and apply those principles. That's absolutely the way we function, we're at the center. And our whole thinking is that way, this omnidirectional observation. If the universe found it expedient to have human beings really specialists, she would have had them born with some, have a microscope on one eye and a telescope on the other, and they could get on greater. But we were not meant to be that way. We were meant to be then omni-medium, omni-direction, omni-environment operative. And we've given principles then to permeate and occupy larger and larger environments to finally get all the more about no tiny planets and get over to the next operating that moon going around the Earth like this, going around the sun together, so we got a ferry across between these fast moving objects. And we've been able to do that, and we're going to go much further. We're getting probing information much further. Quite clearly, human beings are some kind of local universe operator with a mothership to operate from. And now, putting together all I can about all the total information I've received, I've come to the working conclusion, as Einstein did, that energies given off here, reassociate there, and we have to pay attention to the fact that the physicists have no experimental evidence of energy being either created, being lost, which apparently is eternally regenerative, does go through negative and discontinuity phases and reappearing there. And we're dealing in, not in things anyway, where we discover we're dealing really in pure principle. Where the physicist admits that there is no particle, he is dealing in events, and events in pure principle. And we get to where the information on, in the physics really gives us then positive and negative weights. And when we take the total of all weights of physics, positive and negative, they're clearly identifiable today. They all add up to zero. That we're really dealing in absolutely pure principle. And there's something goes on in the design of this universe, the physical operative, that do give seemingly positional aberration, by virtue of which there does seem to be difference of view of you and I. That each of us might be some kind of one way in which the universe may have come out, because the universe has all those options. Each one of us may be a very fast running hand, one way of playing the game of universe. And so each thing just look a little different, each one of us. Then when I come to thinking about the thinking and about all the information we do have, I have to come to something I gave to you yesterday, that there are lags and rates of recall. Not only are there lags and rates of recall, there are lags and rate of apprehending. You know, this is double take. I did see something. That your senses told you something first, but in turn they're seeing a little more, and look a third time. Sure enough, there's somebody I know. But there's lag in here. The fact that there is lag means we were never really right on with the extraordinary velocity of things we operate. That is, we're always a little out of phase with whatever the really great principles are themselves. That we are inherently aberrated. And that we find what begins to become very fascinating, get into synergetics and which are all the geometries that we have, that you'll be expecting with me here. And our book is just about to come out with the synergetics. It's to discover that really nature has aberrational limits, and she pulsates from the vector equilibrium. That's the absolute zero. Our aberration will never let us stay at the center. We cannot get to the pure center, but nature pulsates through the positive and negative from it into various degrees and all these different kinds of into transformer builders with very, very high frequencies of doing it. So that what we have as an awareness is really one way of being sort of aware of the universe, really checking up in its own principles. I'm checking up in its own integrity of its holding together while it can aberrate. It's really quite a fascinating piece of thinking here as we come to that kind of a challenge. In big pattern, we have the Boltzmann concept of the energies exporting and importing, fortified by the Einsteinian feeling those energies are actually collected and bring about the scenario universe of the new formulation to the and the dying off of the old, the comings apart and the comings together. In that such a pattern, which the science, and particularly astronomers, astrophysicists, have been very aware of for a long time, they have realized, of course, that all the stars are visible to you and I optically by virtue of being in trouble with all the energies they give off. So they give us high notice of their presence by virtue of giving off. Then this would mean then that where energies are being imported and collected, give off nothing. And there'd be nothing for you and I to see. So we are only aware of the giving off parts, but they assume there must be collecting parts in order to have the eternal regeneration. So the only possibility would be that we'd bounce something off something, but everything's such motion that by the time the information comes back, you bounce something off something that many generations have gone by and somebody's got to have something out there. But suddenly it became very interesting to realize that when you don't think about Earth as standing still in the middle of the universe, when you really get your senses going along with your knowledge, that we are then a little collecting, we're an importing center of the universe, where the sun's radiation and this other star radiation is being impounded by the photosynthesis. Just think of that extraordinary matter. The energy is given off by the sun, as we've been able to see in the most recent photographs we have from space with the least aberration of optical aberration. These extraordinary flames that's going out incredible distances, but enormous irregularity. And the you and I on our planet just far enough away so life doesn't get dehydrated and burned up by this enormous radiation. And the radiation coming through the atmosphere, we would be burnt up if we get outside of it just nakedly, so they have to have all the spacesuits when you do go out there. But the sun radiation is then refracted and met by the Van Allen belt and by the ionosphere, dealt enormously by the atmosphere, and bent into red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. So that then we get the non-lethal concentrations of the energy being separated out and getting bent more by the waters of the earth. And so many bendings that finally the sun radiation, instead of being bounced off reflectively off a polished ball, getting bent, and impounded on our planet. But that energy being caught as heat and heating up the waters of the ocean. Three-quarters of the earth being covered with water, and water taking on heat and losing it, letting it off more slowly than any other substance. So it's very stabilizing energy impounder of the water, stabilizing the heat operating around our earth to such an extraordinary extent that the annual variations, as you all know, do not really add up to 1 degree Fahrenheit over very enormous periods of time. If it gets this little variation and work towards an ice age, you're a little away from the ice age. And so we find then that within this extraordinary thermal balance, all that beautiful sun radiation would say the clouds there, they get in the way, so that there's great irregularity of the receipts, and yet they get bent and get in this beautiful orderly heat. Absolutely. So superbly balanced that you and I, consisting very much of the same ingredients as the sea water, that you and I, if in good health, no matter what our age, no matter what clothes we're wearing, no matter where we are geographically, if we're in good health, bipolar heat, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And we're an incredible energy balancer. And this is not only nature makes the tree hydraulically, but she makes you and I hydraulically. And so the beautiful firmness of our flesh is then that hydraulic pressure, which is not compressible. So, and it distributes its load, so you and I can run into all these things and not get hurt. And we're giving them bipolar heat, that 98.6 degrees, so it won't freeze. So the load distributed can go on. And given just think of the delicate balance we really are in here compared to the temperatures that our operative to get once you get outside that biosphere. Incredible piece of design. Now, finding us then, impounding the sun radiation and the vegetation impounding it for the human beings, because the human beings can't do it, the mammals can't. And what they do is to take those random receipts because there's a cloud going by and so forth, different kind of intensity of the sun today, all those random receipts converted into beautiful, orderly molecular structures. Incredible. This is exactly the opposite of entropy. Entropy is the increase of random element, and here we are, syntropic, I use the word sin here, as I do synergy and energy, and syntropy and entropy. Entropy coming apart in disorderly ways, syntropy coming together in increasingly orderly ways. We apparently had a syntropic center in the uterus, where then the vegetation having powdered made it move through hydrocarbon molecules, then other biologicals could take it on. They continually multiply those beautiful hydrocarbon molecules. And they get buried more and more deeply in the earth. You and I call it fossil fuels, but nature is burying energy in an extraordinarily orderly manner, such a way that as we find, you take out that petroleum, turn it into petrochemicals, you make incredible, absolute orderly controllability to come out any way in design. All this being impounded here. So we're at a syntropic center of the universe, where sometime the energies would be impounded against possibly becoming a star. And that would probably take, by the general records indicate, certainly another 10 billion years from now. And by this time, whatever you and I are, as local information handlers, we'll probably be very remote. So it's just all right for us to become a star. In the general scheme of things, the rate at which we are learning to get around, this seems perfectly reasonable. Now, I want to then think about we're on board of the centropic center where energy is being collected, and where the energy is being randomness is converted into orderliness by the biosphere, by everything around us. We keep finding turning into order. And the biological growth is to make more order, to make more orderly babies, most extraordinary organisms. The incredibility of the beauty of all those designs, whether it's the atoms or the multiplying the atoms in pure principle. And all the behaviors are absolutely reliable here. Now, amongst them, all the biologicals, as I said, the mammals cannot impound the sun radiation. And they can multiply the hydrocarbons and get to be pretty big and pretty fat, a big tree. Then the hydrocarbons don't get lost, even though the particular operation of that particular organism, they call it its life, meant to be there. So the hydrocarbons don't get lost. The centropic process is really going on and going on in an extraordinary way, making better and better topsoil here. And we find that when you get to the topsoil of our Earth, the chemical elements that are present in the topsoil are not present deep within the Earth, but we find that the 92 regenerative chemical elements, 91 of them have been found on Earth, but most of them are near the surface of the Earth. The great large abundance of the high variety of relatively small ones are near the surface. Apparently, as star recedes from the rest of the universe. When we go through the tail of a comet, we get as much as 100,000 tons of stardust a day being deposited on our surface of Earth. So here we are, a centropic center, receiving some extraordinary inventory of equipment from the rest of the universe and gradually discovering about principles that are operative. And amongst them, all the biologicals, we cannot multiply the hydrocarbon molecules as fast as trees or elephants. But what we can do, we have this extraordinary mind. And I said to you last night, as we finished, what is common to all human beings of all history? Problem solving. We're here for problem solving. And we're able to solve it in principle, and none of the others can solve it in principle. But we have this access to that extraordinary design capability of the universe itself. It gives us as far as we know, by far the most powerful centropic function in the universe. Boy, that's quite a responsibility. And that we, in our ignorance and our fear, looking out for two sides, can get into the negative of trying to kill, this seems very paradoxical. But I would think quite clearly we're getting to the point where this is so paradoxical, it's about to cease. In other words, I spoke to you about our all coming out of some common womb of permitted ignorance with enough cushion of resources by trial and error to make mistake after mistake, to learn what you're learning. And this is a very extraordinary moment, I find, who suddenly there is all around the world literacy. Just wasn't there when I was young. When Russia had its revolution just yesterday, I was 22 years of age when the Russian Revolution occurred. And they were more than 90% illiterate. They couldn't get anywhere without licking that literacy, first thing. All around the world, that literacy being licked. And nobody knew we were going to have this radio and the beautiful diction and gradually leveling out of words. How do you say the words? So we get that common speech is just proliferating everywhere. We have extraordinary intercommunicability, and the rate at which we're all processing information, learning about these principles is just incredible. When I was young, kids barely got on into high school. Some 1% could get on to high school. At times, they had to go off to jobs. See, 1929, by then I'm 34 years of age, we were getting where something like 1% was getting into the high school and going on graduating from high school. There was a very small percentage getting college. This all changed. We're getting where everybody is entitled to go in and get all through the school and get into college, get a PhD. It's absolutely new moment of a man on our planet. You should say, you're going to have to go to work just as soon as you can stand up down. And then when I was young, there was still in many places in the world, there were kids who were going to work in the mines at 6, going to work in the mills at 6 or 8. It's all changing. Now, just in my lifetime, we'd double life expectancy. All the things have been said that are going to be absolutely fatal when I was young, probably all absolutely fatal. Another way to cure it. Meningitis, no way to cure it, absolutely curable. All these things have been incurable, and I said, we find that we can cure. So I find an absolutely different set of conditions obtaining, and instead of them, a pharaoh being informed by grand vizier, and everybody else just follows what the whip does and tells them to do. Then we get to the nobles on the knowledge, then we get to a middle class in the, now everybody's in on it. This is a very extraordinary moment. That's really what our being here together is about. That I really feel inspired to do what I'm doing. That our host inspired say uses equipment and makes them recording. We're supposed to be doing what we're doing here. That's what I feel, what an extraordinary reality of our being here together. So thinking about then our function in the universe with this beautiful mind, I want to find a good working example of an analogy at a scale that you and I can comprehend. Because when I talk about an eternally regenerative universe, and of which you and I just in a very short amount of time have been able to take, I remember when Harlow Shapley first discovered a galaxy. That there are galaxies other than our own. I was fully grown. And suddenly that we have now over a billion galaxies, actually photographed them. Incredible going on there. Now, trying to, and you and I just can't think. One reason I showed you last night this picture of this expanding flame phenomenon. You remember expanding at a rate where just a little over one day, its rate of expansion is the distance between Earth and the Sun. And yet it looks like it stays absolutely no motion there. So we cannot really get the feeling. Our reflexes are not allowed to participate. If really could, then we'd burn up if we got in there, that kind of information. So here we are in this extraordinary, beautiful biosphere with the operating conditions with the great galaxy and balance where you and I are then are hydraulically designed and so forth. I want you to think about a complex design accomplished by human beings. And I find the carelessness with which people talk about a Boeing 747. You know, I know, I've flown that, they're not good. But a Boeing 747 is a very extraordinary device. And it goes through the sky, through the air, at a velocity equivalent to 10 times the velocity of a hurricane. Now, the resistance in the air increases as a second power. So the ferocity, the actual engineering ferocity of interaction of that Boeing 747 with the environment is 100-fold the ferocity of a hurricane that you and I experience. Just multiply that 100-fold. And yet so superbly designed to stay nice and shiny and nothing's going to be going on. No trouble. The man has been able to understand principle enough really to develop the alloys of those aluminums. Using those massive attractive principles of them. You get to the point where he really doesn't know what a ring root is. When the Boeing 747 goes, they say it's a little bumpy, fasten your seat belts. It's a pretty big thing there, weighing 200 tons, and you say it's a little bumpy, 200 tons doing this. The fact is when we're going through thermals, and the airs do not move horizontal to the earth, but they're going up and down, positive and negative, like this. You've got enormous clouds. You're going through a thermal rising about 100 miles an hour this way, another one will be going down 100, 200 miles shear effect because it's a little bumpy. The actual stresses that are involved are equivalent to taking the Queen Mary over Niagara Falls and saying a little bumpy at breakfast here this morning. The man's been able to handle that kind of forces competently. To really master that much of information and produce it is incredible to me. Now, he's going to then bring this out of the sky. Going to have 150 tons hit the Earth at 150 miles an hour. That usually smashes the eggs, all right. But it comes down, there's music all playing, everybody putting their coat in and paying no attention, incredible capability. Now, that contact is something goes on here. What goes first? The pneumatic tires hit first, distributing the load. Notice. And then what happens? We got hydraulic struts. and the enormous pressure on it pushes water through an enormous system using the frictions of the system. We distribute that up. That's the only place where man has really done the design, as nature has done in designing a tree or a human being with hydraulics. Only the landing gave that airplane. But by virtue of the hydraulic distribution of the loads and the pneumatic distribution of the loads, we can do it. Do it in that beautiful way. Now, that Boeing 747 flying through the sky, getting people safely from here to there, in order to be able to do it, there's almost 1,000 instruments. And those instruments are showing you, giving you every critical piece of information on that ship, exactly where all the stresses are, what the heats are, what the pressures are. Anything is going to be known to be mildly critical, where there could be any variability, that information comes up on the dials. And alongside them are usually the second dial, where you can just move something and balance the needle in that one, and automation takes over. But the beautiful metering going on, done by, again, man learning about the invisible kinds of behaviors of atoms that give us all kinds of electronic behaviors. So we get this under control. But every once in a while, there's a lack of information coming on in those dials. And the captain, chief pilot, got all these secretary engineers and pilots, but the captain says, the information not coming in, something has really gone wrong here. Go off automation everywhere. I got to take over manual. And it takes over. And only by virtue, as a human being, having access to principles of the universe, can he save that ship. And very often he does. I would then say, if I were designing an eternally regenerative universe, in contradiction to a little Boeing on a little planet Earth, an eternally regenerative universe, with absolute disintegrity, with incredible technology that is operative, I think you need local instrumentation, getting local sensing of what are the critical information. And you certainly need locally a monitor, like that pilot outside, who has access to great rules themselves in order to be able to solve critical problems. I think that's just what we're here for. We're here, and we're just at the point where we can really talk about it this way. It seems to keep merging. That's why we're here. We have to use every bit we have of these faculties of apprehending and comprehending and employing principles. That's what we're here for. Now, I want to go jump from that to thinking about something you spoke about earlier, humanity then committed to the concept nowhere nearly enough around, this is the non-thinking. Bureaucracies, great governments, great bureaucracies, and great corporations, great bureaucracies, and there's a struggle in there of you call it in the company politics, bureaucracy politics. Who's going to get the job? Whose family are going to eat? Whose family is going to be safe? And you know, this is the rules, and you know how the boss thinks about that. And you don't do your thinking. You just say, how do I play it safe? So an enormous number of humanity and our in bureaucracy and not thinking. So this thinking capability we have is not being generally employed except by little children. And little children spontaneously start thinking, ask most beautiful questions. And then they get told down, never mind, you better not do that, it's going to get family in trouble, etc., etc. And they get negative until each child is a little less put upon in this manner because the information that is coming in is so absolutely contradictory to the traditional way of looking at things that the older world just can't explain it with conviction anymore. Yeah, you are wrong. And so the child is beginning to think freely. That really is typical of your generation. You are really doing your own. You're not endowed with something that generation before didn't have, but the generation before I was brought up, my mother, my father died when I was very young. My mother said, darling, this man's saying a lot of trouble to talk to you. He's a great friend of your father. And I say, I didn't like what he said. And mother said, never mind what you think. Pay attention to this man. He doesn't want to sing. He's taking a lot of trouble. And I've continually been told, never mind what you think. Pay attention. And I was being sent to the school where they're going to really show me. And so I continually found what I was thinking a little out from what I was being taught. So I assumed that I was just a freak. And I have to get on with myself as a freak. So I don't know how many of you really had the often think that way about yourself, but I guess you had to live with the free. You're just not being told anymore. Never mind what you think. And you have the thinking capabilities always there, and just not being discouraged so much. This is my biggest hope that we're going to make it here is that this thinking is being manifest and really employed by the young world. And will it get going fast enough to overcome the inertias and the bureaucracies and the fears in operative in those bureaucracies? It's a very touch and go question. Even though I now know that we have the option to make man, I really know how. I know what all the things we have to do design-wise to get there. That we'll do it. I have the slice idea. But I'm deeply moved as I begin to see one more manifest a little more out for us in the newer freedoms of that young world. Because each child being born is being born in the presence of less misinformation. Each child being born in the presence of a lot more reliable information. And they're paying attention. So they're thinking with very good inputs of data. The operation conditions are very, very much improved all the time, and each child a little better off. I can go at any point the way I'm talking to big patterns. I could really digress and get in great details. You find me on structures, for instance, just getting down to the way the tree is designed or whatever it may be. I'm really quite deliberately avoiding going in any depth in these first days. I'm trying as I can to keep at the bigger concepts. And I hope you begin to share with me this concept of the function of human beings. Whether I'm really right or wrong, I don't have the slightest idea. Of course I don't know. But it does not seem to be, I don't find any argument against it. And I find it to be very, very good argument for it. So that for the moment I feel I can accept it as a hypothesis that is reasonable, that we are here then as problem solvers and that we're given particularly metaphysical problems to solve in principle. Therefore, we might have to get more and more courage to really go along with principles and have less and less fear of upsetting the tradition and the game and be less and less afraid of those who are afraid. Now, I'm going to bring in one more a principle that I talked to you about, and this goes back to 1927 in my life when I was 30 years of age. And I became, I'd had by good fortune really an acceleration in finding out a great deal about what doesn't work. And I'd really been so enthusiastic about the people who loved me and told me how to play the game. I tried to play the game, but I was not thinking, I was playing the game. And I learned to play the game very well, but then it came to a real head-on crash. So that 1927, we had our second child born, our first child having died 5 years earlier at the age of four. And the loss of that first child was just an incredibly sad matter. So suddenly a new child entrusted to us, and we were penniless, and I really felt very strongly many of the things you've heard me talking about here. I hadn't anywhere nearly the time to make the nice models that we have, but my feelings were pretty strong in pure principle about these things existing. I felt that quite clearly all my contemporaries had on highest priority in their lives that they had to earn a living. They hoped they might earn it in a way that would be pleasant to them, but pleasant or not, you got to earn a living. That was very hard. Your generation is not overwhelmed that way, but we were really overwhelmed by it to such an extent I didn't hear anybody even think of contradicting it. It seemed to be so obvious. It took it that way. And it began to occur to me that this is really nonsense. What we all ought to be doing is saying, what does my experience teach me needs to be attended to? And if not attended to, humanity will be in great trouble. And if attended to successfully, will bring great advantage to humanity. And what would I need to know more than I already know, other than having enough experience to realize it is so? What more do I need to know in order to be doing something about it? And what if I am going to do something about it, what is the nature of what I'm going to do about it? Am I just going to try to tell people it's there? Am I going to try to reform people? And I said, number one, here I am. Fact is, I am absolutely penniless. I have no credit. and I feel and see these things. How do you carry on? I said, it could be that the little individual, human being, really has a very great advantage over great corporations and great states. What can the individual do that this corporation can't do? Corporations are legal entities. They can't do equivalent to a human being. Number one, the corporation can't think. You know, only human beings can think. And I said, only a human being then could really operate on his own. He doesn't have to have anybody say yes or no. If he really thinks and sees that so, he can act like that. And luckily he can. The time again, he can save the ship. But boy, he has to go fast. And has to operate in a very enormous confidence and principle. So I said, all right, I see then this earning a living is in the way. And one of the principles, but I was deeply moved by having been in regular Navy, been early flying, so forth, really, of the employment of principles. I really have enormous confidence what you can do with principles. The principle of leverage, and the absolute count on that mass center of traction, whatever it may be. I've mentioned to you earlier the fact then that the human life on board of our planet, as mentioned earlier today, concept of man possibly having a very important, really a very central function in the universe as a local monitor of problem solving. And in those terms, assuming that human beings are then necessary, needed, not here just to be pleased or displeased, not to do things just from the viewpoint of the ignorance of little man, but something to do with the great wisdom of an extraordinary integrity of the universe, then assuming then that pattern of human beings being necessary and useful to the universe, and the ability to have them on board, requiring then that they do take on energy and take it on socially in certain extraordinary ways. We call it digestion. They're coarse, crude words for what really goes on when we put energies inside and what goes on with very routine to glands. We don't know much about this. But the point is that in order to be able to have that carry on, to re-energize us and carry us so forth, we do have to have all this great ecological phenomena. Because we need radiation, we need energy to start off with, and mammals can't take it through the skin. So I've talked about that with you before, vegetation having to impound the sun radiation, and vegetation having to be rooted, I give you all those reasons. So then with the vegetation all rooted, and this is then the vegetation rooted there, in the chemical process of the photosynthesis, giving off various gases, making other gases, but giving off gases. And the gases given off by the vegetation would soon occupy the whole of the atmosphere, and the vegetation would be able to carry on and walk. It needs another kind of input gas. Therefore, all the mammals are designed to take in the gas that's given off by the vegetation and convert it, and we use what we want, and then what we give off is what the vegetation needs. So this is incredible reciprocity design that human beings pay no attention to as they begin to open up real estate developments and knock down trees. Nobody's talking about this. The respiratory gas exchange is not in the calculating at all in town planning or engineering. Nobody. All right, we find then that vegetation rooted. And vegetation being rooted cannot reach other vegetation appropriately. And because it then can't reach it, then we have all the insects, butterflies, extraordinary creatures. Worms, crawlers, flyers, swimmers, going back and forth between the vegetation, which do all the energy impounding, and going after something in that vegetation and inadvertently cross-pollinizing. So in order to have the whole thing regenerative, we had to have then all those creatures given chromosomic drives so that honeybee is designed to go after his honey. It goes into one flower after another and inadvertently knocks off pollen. Again, precessionally at 90 degrees. He goes this way, and the result is this way. Whether he gets honey or not is absolutely nature gives him that, so he'll do this little trick. But the honey business is not. The big thing is to regenerate the solar system. I found that the human beings, being given hunger and thirst, and all, they go after them their honey. And they inadvertently didn't mean to, but we had side effects again, 9 degrees, to make babies over here. So then they got a responsibility to the baby, and also given an urge to look out for that young. So they got the side effects here bothering them a lot, and they got to get out more of that honey. And so they learned then, I can make grow peas, and he makes him shoes, and makes more shoes than he can wear, and I can grow more peas than I can eat. We want to exchange. So looking out for these side effect kids here, that needs an enormous amount of interchange. So finally we sort of invent a unitary honey called money. So we go money being, everybody goes money being, getting I earn that living. And inadvertently do some logical things. And because we are so preoccupied with fear, looking out for our young, so, and really I find primarily the fear of human beings is not for themselves, but human beings are really very brave. It really is for those that allow them, that really depend on them. Then they really get very fearful. So we have then this fear in those human beings and doing this. And then, so then they produce guns, and that's not a very good idea. But in producing the gun, they really learn how to develop production capability. So they can produce non-gun, they can produce life support. And they begin to do some, being able to take care of a lot more people. All the great changes in the numbers of people really has been advanced, and the breakdown in the death rate, the enormous increase in longevity, all these things are consequence of his doing the right things for the wrong reasons, and it's negative. You had to get him going. So I don't find any fault with any of these things that human beings have done, because I really see nature is in the fulfillment, and that's not the eternal way of carrying on. It is part of the due process of humanity getting to where it can really function here. So then I see that what nature is really doing then is really precession. It is 90 degrees. As I said the other day, the effect of bodies and motion on other bodies in motion is to make them go into orbit and not to fall in. So this sort of going after, you're falling into flowers and so forth, is that 180 where the big thing is this way. So that's what man called this side effect. That's the main effect, and this is a side effect. I said, what I see is now that nature is trying then to maintain a regenerative system. If then I give up altogether the idea of wasting my time, money hunting, and I really commit myself to what needs to be done and begin to employ the principles, I may really find, since that's what nature really wants to have happen, I may find I'll get on. But I can't make bargains and nobody to write in a contract with me. I've got to go on my intuition and my sense of the truth. I've got to really go on my mind, and I've got to continually say, is this as far as I'm supposed to go? I get frustrated, but maybe that's as far as I'm supposed to go with this particular one. What is the next high priority? What are the tender? Learning then to move this one and move that one. And I've had to make incredible mistakes. But in 1927, I did deliberately undertake to carry on from there on, forget to ever again earning a living. And I had there's a new child. I assure you that my family, my friends, my wife's friends and family thought I was really an incredibly stupid and treacherous character. But it's not easy to get people to understand. It takes quite a lot of time to get to understand that precession and to understand the kind of confidence I really had in it. I said, if I can prove that the little, I'm just the right one to prove it. I want to prove what an average, healthy human being can do with the faculties we are all given if he's really disembarrassed this nonsense of earning a living. In view of this sudden accumulation of information, which was very different in my day from what had been my father's day, I thought we're probably at a critical moment when we're supposed to be behaving differently. So we need to have somebody who is penniless make the experiments if we can get on. So that's exactly what it did. I find myself being introduced to many audiences, because I do really meet thousands of them, and often usually being introduced in a very generous way, being called names like genius. And I hurry to point out that everybody is born genius, And that if there's anything important about me at all is that I am a demonstration of what an average healthy human being can do if he's disembarrassed of the nonsense that he has to earn a living and really commits himself to what the universe is trying to do. And I'm now so confident, having been going through this for almost a half century, and I'll show you that getting on was difficult, but it's a big slow cycle. And there's no place where you can ever say that I'm being supported now for what I did there. It's completely disconnect. Simply a matter of acting in integrity, and you find somehow or other get on. There are a set of complete inadvertencies that begin to happen where somebody asks you, you were talking, you didn't know they're going to want you to talk, and they have very surprising funds to do it, so that takes care of this particular. You never had, you can't, it's anything but a capitalist kind of game of building up, but just that. I find I'm willing to take care of more and more activity. My income has increased and increased for all these years. There's really quite a large amount to go through our books today, but I spend every bit of it. And I must continually be spending it, trying to make judgments that this really might get humanity somewhere. And there are enormous numbers of young people who have very important ideas that you've learned enough about. Is that one that really might get humanity somewhere? So. That's the kind of game I live in. Therefore, at this point in my life, I don't feel that I'm being precious to a young world, and I say, you can really forget all the other earning a living, provided you really commit yourself to the other man. If you're doing something that's sort of make you feel good, if you're playing an ego, you were like Mr. McFaul, no, don't do this. You can only do this if you really commit yourself truly, syntopically, the idea. And synergetically, it has to be everybody and nobody. And really, out and out. Well, I've introduced to you lots of patterns, and I've then tried to explore principles, and I hope you... I think I've had enough experience with what I'm talking about to say I can now eliminate this as being just a coincidence about this. But I'll tell you, in learning to be able to say that, I had to make many, many mistakes. Any number of times when I did get cold feet, or somebody else getting cold feet on my behalf said, come over, take this job, and things always went wrong when you went off there. You had to really commit yourself absolutely to the complete deep end, or it doesn't work. So you have to work on an incredible faith in the integrity of our universe. When I began to have to do my own thinking, the number one question I had to ask myself was the following. I said, you've been taught to believe this and that. Your grandmother loved you to pieces. She told me about somewhere down in Mesopotamia 2,000 years ago. Said, down, you're too young to know. But there's been a relaying of people who do love and do want to be truthful, and this is the way it seems to be. And I said, if I'm going to do my own thing, I've got to give up all the beliefs I ever had. And I don't want to be unkindly to my condition reflex thoughts, my mother, my grandmother, or people I would love to pieces. I'm going to have to really question everything, come back to my own experiences, or to the experience of somebody who, it's my experience, is faithful and tell me about his experiences, not what he believes, or what he asks me to believe, but what do we experience? So I said, all right, you have experienced all around you, all around the world, a fervor of human beings, a sense that there are all those churches and synagogues and an enormous number of human beings who really feel apparently that something's going on, there's something operating in the universe that's more important and more competent and more reliable than that. I said, if you're going to do your own, in your own experience, do you have any reason to have to assume there's a greater intellect and integrity operating in the universe than that of man? I said, if you're going to really ask yourself that, I'm overwhelmed by it, because I really have learned about leverage. I really have learned the mass attraction. I'm just overwhelmed at this, because it can only be discovered intellectually. It is entirely intellectual. There's quite clearly there's a manifest of an extraordinary intellectual integrity operating in the universe. Nothing to do with any shape or form or anything. Complete abstraction. You and I can never quite get to the truth. We can say it a little better. You and I know of it, and we can be inspired by it. So I made complete commitment then, back in 1937, to this intellectual integrity of the universe. And I said, if I really shoot the works, I don't know very deeply, if you keep your sensitivity, whether you're really on or not on, you're supposed to go this far, when you stop and go, what next we take up. I think this is a very good time to stop tonight. I'll tell you that as we go on, I'm going to get in really quite depth. Since I gave you exposure to map, I don't tell you how I designed this map and why it does not have the aberrations and the misinformation and the other methods of projection. I'll be able to show you exactly why it has the least possible deformation. In going from spherical to flat, there is aberration. But this has the going again to limit cases, has the most evenly distributed error. So much so it's absolutely symmetrical. It's just that there is no visible distortion in this map. There is distortion, but I've been able to keep it in magnitudes that are sub-visible. I have the principle to. So I'm going to say goodnight and I will keep searching and I didn't know what I was going to say the first time. I didn't have known really what I was going to say. I want everybody to realize the reality of this, and I'm sure hope the picture doesn't take out a moment of thinking, because I was thinking very hard in there, and you were thinking hard. That's very much a part of this picture. And I am going to be able then to hold this tapestry together. And now I've said enough so I really begin to see and think about other things that I know, and I will not be quite as slow in introducing them. But things are going to move really very rapidly as we get into details of various areas. I will then get over to this comprehensive and anticipatory design science and get into what it is you and I, what I've learned is the strategies that human little individual can employ and how it can be most effective on behalf of its fellow human beings. So, tonight.